Cunningham for another extraordinary message on Gill Athletics Connections.
All right, here we go. We are back. You're back once again for the Gill Athletics Connections Track and Field Podcast. I'm so humbled to be your host, Mike Cunningham, National Business Development Manager for Gill Athletics. Before I introduce this week's guest, I do have to kind of just bare my soul here for a second. So because we like nice big round numbers, if you've noticed, this is episode number 250. That's a lot. And that's just our guest episodes. As you know, if you're a frequent listener here, we do a lot of bonus episodes on Thursdays and throughout the years. We got a really cool everyday bonus thing coming up in April and May that I hope you're around to listen to. But, you know, after 250 episodes, so, you know, over 250 coaches from all levels, private, public, middle school, all the NCAA levels, NAIA, junior college, et cetera. You know, I continually get feedback from you, from other coaches, from listeners about what this podcast has done for them. It has grown a life that's bigger than I ever thought. I thought this would just be an interview show and we'd, you know, move on. But it's brought a lot of value to people out there, which brings a lot of value to me. So I just want to say thank you. This podcast continues in year five, which is just amazing to me, season five here. And I'm really, really excited for, you know, again, we like big round numbers, really excited that, you know, kind of got someone special here for us here on episode 250. So without further ado, help me welcome the head coach, the director of track and field from the University of Oklahoma, the Sooners, baby. Here we go. Welcome the wise, the wonderful Mr. James Thomas. James, how are you, sir?
I'm awesome, Mike, man. I appreciate you having me on here. And 250 is kind of a unique number because that'd be like a one bar progression over the high jump world record. And so this like has multiple meanings to me now. So now I appreciate you having me on, man.
See, you just established yourself as high jump nerd right there. I love that. That was good. That was really good. I've lost all my metric abilities anymore. The only metric I still remember is 6'10". For the long jump is 20 feet and a quarter. And the only reason I remember that is I had a young lady jump 6'09" and I thought that was 20 feet. And I was like, wow, my first 20 foot long jumper. And then you see the actual results. And it was 19.11 and 3. And I was like, you have, and there is no 20 feet even. I was just like, you've got to be kidding me. She ended up jumping like 640, 650. So we got well over it.
But, okay. You got past that. Good for you.
But, but all this, you know, someone says, oh, my kid jumped 211. And I'm like, yeah, what's that, man? I don't know anymore. I've lost it. James, thanks for being here today for a couple of reasons. One, you know, it's kind of weird. You know, we like round numbers, right? 200, 250, 300 is really awesome. Weird. I don't know why that, you know, I don't know why 250 is more important than 251, but it is for some reason. So I wanted to, you know, kind of always have a special guest, someone that, you know, I admire highly that I think has an interesting background that I have a relationship with. And so for you, for me to have you is kind of a big deal, man. I've admired you for a long time. We'll get into some stories, I'm sure, about that. And I'm personally just excited for you in your new role here as the head coach, director of track and field at Oklahoma, man. So first of all, congratulations. Have you had time to even catch your breath?
It's weird. Like, I think there's two parts to this thing. You kind of hop in something mid-year, which is ultimately we're not the football world where bowl season ends and everybody goes scattering in December. I'm in my mind, I'm geared up, ready to go take this squad that I have at Georgia and get ready to go hit this thing. And, you know, and then this curveball kind of hits. And so, but the one fortunate part, it's track season. So the one thing about track season, this is what we do. We coach, we do this. And so, if there's meetings going on between Thursday and Saturday or whatever, I'm not there. I'm focused on track and field. And so between getting a travel itinerary and getting on the road, this is about as comfortable as a setting as I know, because this is what we've been doing, what I've been doing for the last 21 years and getting on the road, traveling, hopping on buses, hopping on planes. And so there's a hard part and the easy part. And thankfully, I've always appreciated track being that easy part. It's my outlet. It's it's my safe space in a way. So, you know, being away from my family for 6 months and doing things like that for a little while, this is probably what's kept me sane and kept me happy and kept me in a place where I'm like, you know, you realize the decisions that you make, they played out for a reason. And I'm definitely fortunate to be here.
Well, we're going to dive into it a little bit deeper as we go along your story. It strikes me the way you just described that, the word I just kind of was picturing, you didn't say this word, but watching your face as you were talking about it, the word that came up to me was fun. Like,
You seem like you have fun when you're out there. You talked about that Thursday through Saturday. That's fun for you.
Yeah, no, it's track and field. Like, it's never felt like a job. I've always wondered, you know, and you look at people who work 9 to 5 or even longer hours and things like that. And I look at a lot of people, even athletic trainers and things, they have a true job and mission, in my opinion. Ours, we get to go live vicariously through a bunch of 18 to 23 year olds and get to play a game and get to play a sport and get to see these, you know, these athletes just kind of do what they love and kind of get to inspire and lead and motivate. And so it's never felt like work. So it's always been fortunate for me to be in a line where, you know, these couple decades pass by like a snap of a finger. And I feel like, man, you know, I hope I never have to get a real job one day.
Hey, you know, I had to go get a real job one day, but it ended up being this interviewing people around the country. So, you know, it's
awesome,
not always terrible.
it's very similar. And there's things and passions that I like, that I enjoy, that I always felt like, man, if I really, you know, if I didn't want to just be kind of a broke coach all my life, I could probably go do this and make some money, do that. But there's nothing that I've ever thought that I could do with the same amount of passion that I do with coaching and interacting with young people and other coaches across the country. And I'm still a student myself. So opportunity to learn and grow in this sport, it's always kept me engaged.
Love it. Love it. Well, let's learn more about you. Let's hop back in our Wayback Machine here. Where does track and field start for you? I don't know if you were a track athlete, a multi-sport athlete. Where does track and coaching kind of start for you?
Okay. Yeah, I have a probably unique story in this. It kind of goes way back. I mean, I'm from Houston area. I went to actually called Katy. I went to Mater Creek High School. Out in Katy ISD. It used to be part of the Cypress Fairbanks. We kind of shifted that way later, and it was May Creek and two other schools that made up the Katy ISD. Now it's probably 7A, whatever A high schools they have out there, 6A high schools, and it's grown, and there's 10-lane, 12-lane highway going through it. But I started there as a dual sport basketball track athlete. State and high jump. I was a jumper, long, triple, and high, and that was always my thing. But you know, as younger days, you know, I was quarterback. I always had a good arm, but my biggest thing was basketball. And I knew I was gonna play basketball in college, but I also wanted to run track. Okay. That was big for me. And so when I took a number of visits, I went to a lot of what we call today the Power Five schools, and I ended up landing kind of last second. It's a really, really unique story with all the recruiting going on, all the things happening. I ended up taking a last second. We had a family reunion and kind of got motivated by my family. And I chose a school that wasn't even recruiting me. It was Southern University. That's where all my family had graduated from. My uncle played football there. My dad went there. My mom, she was the bougie one. My aunt was the bougie one. She went to Tulane. She's the only one in the family that didn't graduate from Southern. So I decided to go out there and take that same route. It didn't quite work for me. And so, you know, from what I was trying to do, basketball, track wise, all that kind of stuff. And so I actually made a shift in those days. If you made any kind of transfer from a basketball, you're sitting out, and I didn't want to sit out. And so one of my former kind of mentors, coaches, I was working at a place in Nampa, Idaho called Northwest Nazarene University. It was an NAIA school. And so I was like, you know what? I can move mid-year and I can have an opportunity to kind of go here and continue to play basketball because I didn't want to stop. And also tie into some track and field stuff because they're eager for me to potentially do both. And I was like, okay, I'll go park it there for a year, almost treat it like a little small segment of my time and go see what I can make happen there. And I ended up going there and that's where I fell in love with track. It was a unique thing. Randy Dalzell was, you know, he was the head coach there. It was kind of distance oriented. And I went in there and I had three events that broke three school records out of high school. And so I had an opportunity to start kind of coaching and learning. And I was out there recruiting volleyball players. I was out there recruiting. I just wanted teammates. Hmm. And so that's when I started reaching out to every coach I could find across the country. And that's when I connected with Curtis Collier and who ended up being the Sam Houston head coach later down the line. And that's where I ended up actually going and finishing up everything at Sam Houston State. But that's when I became kind of a track nerd. That's when I started doing level one stuff. I did level one training, and I'm still a sophomore in college. I just like, I got to start learning this stuff. I'm intrigued because it was one of those few sports that felt so pure to me. Like I couldn't blame anybody. Playing basketball and going to a lower level at the time, which still ended up being extremely competitive. NAIA and all those other sports still have their own competitiveness to it. And you still got to put it in the same hoop. So it's still the same complexity to it. And so that challenged me in a way, but also opened my eyes to okay, now it's not, I can't blame my point guard. I can't blame my center. I can't blame the play that was called in track. It was just kind of me and a lane or a runway or apron. And I was like, yeah, this is kind of what I want to do. But I also remember looking at film at 6 a.m. and doing film again at 7 p.m. and doing this at 9 p.m. Like, man, at some point I want to have this house, this dog with a picket fence, and I don't know when I ever get to see it if I'm doing this basketball thing. And so track and field, like I didn't study anybody. I studied our people. When I went home, I could, if I want to disconnect, I could disconnect. And it was really simple to do. And so that work-life balance, which has always been important to me, is and has always been a staple of kind of who I believe in myself. It's something that it fit my pattern, my flow of what life should be with sport, with jobs, with whatever. And so, yeah, that's how I made that full transition, moving on to Sam Houston State. And I knew from there I would have an opportunity to coach right away when I got done. And so, and working with Curtis Carter, who's a mastermind level 3, kind of he was kind of really a big mentor for me growing up. I still have every workout that I've ever done with him from 20 years ago, 20 plus years ago, and it's just really helped guide me to the person I am today.
Let's unpack some of that. That's an amazing story and journey. I love that. Let's go back to high school. You were doing a lot of different sports. You kind of settled on basketball and track. There's still that was back in 90,
I graduated in 98.
98. Okay, so I know you're a few years younger than me. I graduated in 94. Okay, so this is in the 90s. Here we are in 2024, and we're still arguing, debating about multi-sport athletes and what you should or should not be doing. How did you and really, to bring in the mentors, the coaches that you had, how did you guys figure out the flow of what, you obviously were a promising athlete. So, I couldn't blame the basketball coach if they said, no, I want James, basketball 365 because he'll be even better. And the track coach going, yeah, but he's a great jumper. If I had him 365, he'd be a better jumper. How did you guys coordinate multi-sport athleticism for you? And by the way, you still have, you talk about multi-sport, multi-event type stuff. Academics are still involved in all of this as well. You got to make sure you're graduating. How did you guys and your coaches handle that?
I mean, at the time, I mean, I guess in the 90s, there was never that kind of weird part about how many sports you're going to do. If you want, if it matched season wise, I mean, it wasn't uncommon for people to play three sports. It wasn't uncommon for people to play. It's changed now because there's so many specialties, and now there's parents investing into all these specialties and things like that. So if you're putting that investment, you're like, I'm not going to water down my investment for you to go play another sport. If you're going to be competitive in it, you kind of let it happen. But I've always felt track there. I can't think of a single sport where track can hurt that other sport. And there's just so many things when it comes to the power, speed, even some forms of agility, mobility, coordination. It's such an integral part of everything we do. It's the purest sport we have. And I think that, when you look at other sports, everybody's trying to take a little snippet of what track's doing to help their sport become better. And so, I think that was the way of the world. They almost expected it. But then I think at the time, every single track coach was also some version of a football staff member, So it was kind of that you're going to go out there, you're going to coach this sport, you're going to do this thing. And so it became a way for them to almost punish you more. But at the end of the day, I snuck off to the field event. So I'm like, and I was going to let you have, I was smart enough at the time. You're not about to give me this 400 meter train and then tell me to go over there to the long jump runway and high jump apron. Like, no, if you want to do that, we can do that after. Because it doesn't make any sense on my body because I it just doesn't work. We don't go out there and start practice with a bunch of wind sprints and then go out there and try and do full court press. Like, it
So,
just doesn't.
Coach Thomas in 2024 saying that makes every sense in the world. You were thinking this as a 16, 17, 18-year-old kid?
Absolutely. I don't know
Wow.
why stuff had to match to me. Like, it's just weird. It's almost like outfits and things. Like, there's certain, I'm an analogy guy, and it's some things that people may like. And I think I got this from a Bruce Schneider, but there's a lot of people who like beer, and there's a lot of people who like ice cream. I just don't know a lot of people who like them together, you know? And so I have that beer and ice cream kind of mentality. Like there's a lot of things that I love separately, but I'm never mixing them together and enjoying as one. And that's how training has always been to me. That's how sport has always been to me. That's how life's always been to me. I kind of want to put it in its area where, you know, if it's family kid time, you know, I don't want to mix family kid time with a bunch of work. I don't want to mix a bunch of this with a bunch of that. At some point I need to dedicate, you know, kind of my time, my focus, and, you know, it could be my own attention level, but I function a lot better, and I can multitask well, but I focus a lot better and do a lot better when I get to actually put that focus on stuff. And so, you know, that's why I had the opportunity even, and that's why I had such a great relationship, because I think I was at least a communicator. So I wasn't going to be one of them athletes like, I'm not doing this, I'm doing that, it needs to be this way. I'm just like, well, what do you think about this? You know, because I can think about, you know, when I do this and do that, whatever, you know, what's the benefit of doing this 400 meter training before I go to the high jump apron? Does that really make much sense? And help me out here. And they feel like, oh, yeah, you're probably right. We'll change everybody. Y'all go do this and come back. So, you know, it became something that, you know, you start looking at the science, and I was always a science fan, and in the human body, it just always intrigued me. And so I was always trying to find ways, even at a young age, how to get the most out of your body.
So it sounds like you understood compartmentalism, you know, compartmentalization as a young person. That's hard to get, you know, as an adult. It sounds like as a kid, you understood like, okay, if I'm doing this, I'm going to focus on this. That probably helped you with your multi-sports as well. When you were in basketball season, you probably just focused on basketball. And then when you got to track, started thinking about track.
Yeah, no, that was a big thing. I had to lock in, and there's ways that I can kind of separate it, because when I was even playing basketball, I was still helping coach track, because I never got a chance to do indoor season, but I would go out there and help a lot of the athletes in college and during the indoor season, maybe when I wasn't playing basketball, when I wasn't having practice or I had some off time. So I still wanted to kind of get involved with it, because I knew once the season ended, I was going to be back on the track, and then I'm back with that team. So it was, you know, it was always a unique challenge, blend things that I like I said, but once again, it was all fun. You know, it just grew up in an era where everything we did was outside. Everything we did was playing. Everything we did was I lived in a cul-de-sac, and we turned into two hoops full court, and we did it on rollerblades. We did it on everything. Like, it just, we just turned outside into just like our own version of amusement park. And so it felt weird not having that kind of that version in real life when I became older.
So let's transition to college. I actually like that you went to three different colleges. We'll explore that because I'm not a fan of the demonization that we have today because of the transfer portal of kids transfer, and we'll get to that topic. But what I'm curious about non-athletically, as you were looking to go into school, you mentioned some of the schools you were looking at, and you ended up starting out at Southern down over in Louisiana. What were you thinking academically and like career-wise?
Yeah, I always knew I wanted to coach.
Is that right?
I was social science education major, and I knew that route was something I was inspired by so many coaches, and I just like that part where it's almost like you have an opportunity to change somebody's path. And I came from incredible family, and it wasn't like a coach had to kind of direct me to, right. But the coaches, I saw that the impact they made on other people, and they obviously made them on me myself as well, but I saw the impact they could make. I saw how sports changed people who I thought were going down the wrong path, and all of a sudden I was like, wait a second, this kid is now saying yes sir and lining up and run until he throws up, and this kid wouldn't listen to anybody, wouldn't listen to his mom in the front yard, and all of a sudden this guy is like hugging and crying and holding a grown man because we just won something. Mm-hmm. And so I started realizing the impact that sport really can have on people. Wow. and what coaches mean to people. And then I started realizing the people that had the biggest influence. I started thinking back to my third grade year in PE. I'm like, man, I remember this guy. And I'm like, I'm looking him up. And then I remember my fifth grade PE teacher when I had to switch elementaries because of the result. I'm like, everybody had a big impact. Yeah, I had science teachers, I had math teachers, but that the coaches are the people that kind of help grow you athletically and mentally and physically, they played a big impact. So I knew that was a route I wanted to go. It shifted later once I started going to the college level, because I'm like, oh, no, I want to do this thing at the college level. You know, so I switched from a social science education major to a kinesiology major because I'm like, this human body is unique. And the opportunity to coach, and I started seeing that you can still have that same kind of influence at the collegiate level, because we're just 13th graders. I mean, it's not, you get to college, you're not grown. You're just an extension of high school. So I'm like, I can still make that impact. But I went through everything. I went through, from the education standpoint, the student teaching, all that kind of stuff. I was ready to walk out there with an education degree. And then I flipped it last minute, because I'm like, I got an opportunity. I still got a fifth year. I'm going to go ahead and get this kinesiology major. I have no intentions of probably coaching in high school anymore. And so it worked out well that way.
I like how you put that we're just 13th graders. That's an important lesson for all of us, not just coaches, parents, the kids themselves, that it's not just they flip just because they go from high school to college, that they're grown adults. They're still growing into being adults. I like that. That's really, that kind of struck me, as I have a seventh grade son as my oldest. So I have this like idea of like, oh, he's going to go to high school. Well, automatically he's more of a man now, cause he goes to high school. Right. It's like, yeah, you know what? It's just another year. Just last year he was in eighth grade, you know? Yeah. That's interesting. So, from pretty early on, you want to be a coach. You kind of thought, because it was the example in front of you, you thought, okay, teaching and coaching in the high school level. And then as you got to college, it's like, oh, wait a minute, there's a whole different level of coaching as well, and I want to go there. So you started out at Southern. And then, so talk to me about this transfer, because not just only transferring from NCAA level to NAI level, which, that happens every day. That's not necessarily unusual. But it sounds like you are, I'm going to call you a Southern boy, Houston area, Southern University, and then you go to Idaho. I mean, there has to be some culture shock there. How did that transition go, regardless athletically? Just, I don't want to say fitting in, but them fitting into everything, just culture, everything's different up there versus growing up in the Houston area.
Yeah, it was the first time I think I had a true appreciation for like a college town, a different setting, because everything was just so fast paced. I mean, from Houston and all my family's from New Orleans. I'm the only person in my family that was truly raised in the Houston area, because everybody in my family is New Orleans born, raised, everything else. My dad took a job out in Houston. Weird thing, I was born in Detroit because he was training in Detroit to take the job in Houston. So I lived in two areas that really kind of separated from the family a little bit. But my mom and dad, everybody's Louisiana, and everybody started shifting to more Houston, Texas, definitely post Katrina and everything else like that.
Right.
And so it was one of those weird things when I went there. It's just an eye opening thing. It was obviously much slower pace. I mean, Boise, Idaho was right down the road, 20 minutes down the road. We actually held a national championship back there in Napa one of those years. But when I got there, it was just like, okay, this is I knew the Southern hospitality. I knew that friendliness to it. It was just really unique going to every single grocery store and literally everybody speaking to you, everybody talking to you. It was almost like you walk around, and maybe because I was a 6'5", 200-pound black dude walking in Napa, Idaho, everybody decided to speak to me. But it was just like, I felt friendly before, but I've never felt that friendly. And then it was a liberal arts university. So I didn't grow up in the Nazarene church or anything like that. But, now I'm going to a chapel, multiple times a week, and I'm learning different type of things. I'm getting involved with different. And so it was a way that it just challenged me. I mean, I'm taking courses now that are kind of breaking down every single book of the Bible and doing this. And I grew up in a church. So it wasn't anything different to me, but it was just unique being in that in a school setting and still mixing that with athletics and studies and everything else. So, it just really opened my eyes to what the college experience was about and how different it was for everybody. Cause now that I've been at a Division I, I've been to a summer school at a junior college. Now I'm at an NAIA school that's just transitioning to D2. It was a unique thing to be able to see everything, but also understand from the ground roots of how to work at it. Like, nothing was handed to you. Nothing was easy. You had to fundraise. You had to beg for a pair of spikes. You had to, some things that you take for granted now. It's just, you had an opportunity to really have to earn those things and work for those things and fundraise for those type of things, even at Sam Houston State, so it was, it allowed me, I think it really shaped me to kind of who I am and what I am in coaching today and kind of how I appreciate, I want to say, every level, every coach and every background they come from.
Yeah, that's really important. Sounds like you have at least a medium-sized family, but at least a pretty close family. You already mentioned aunts and family and parents, things like that. Any homesickness?
It was I don't know. I think I had such an independence at that age.
Yeah.
It really wasn't. And once, you know, it's even now when I travel and doing, you know, granted, I'm away from my family. I'm away from my kids and I travel a lot. But, you know, I think I raise it the same way I coach. It's like you coach in independence. They're not tied and drawn just to being stuck to dad. And
Yeah.
there's times where I can be in the same house and I purposely give them their own space. And my kids kind of work independent. And that's kind of how I was kind of raised. And so it gave me that same feeling. And my dad kind of pushed that onto me. So it was never one of them sad goodbyes. Is like, this is your next step of your journey.
Right.
And if you want to accomplish the things you want to accomplish, you go wherever you have to go to get it done. And that probably, you always have your time. I think the first time I was homesick when I had a birthday, and it's a September birthday. And so you're just now starting school and nobody really knows you. So they don't know September's your birthday. So I'm just like, oh, this is the first time, like, man, I miss everybody telling me happy birthday. And cell phones weren't as popular then.
Yeah, that's what I was
if
thinking.
they
It's like
were existing.
we're still in an
Yeah.
era at this point where, you know, email is not really existent. Cell phones are
Yeah.
not existent. Yeah, it's still
Yeah.
hard to communicate.
So it's just like I'm stuck in a room. Like, I wish I could tell everybody, but then it feels weird. Hey, today's my birthday. Hey, today's my birthday. So thankfully,
Right.
that was the first time I had that moment. But other than that, no, I've always had a level of independence that kept me in my own little comfort zone.
It's interesting how you answer that because, you know, we think of homesickness as like, oh, well, if you're not homesick, what's wrong with you? But I have a lot of the same feelings the way how you described it as well. It's like, just because I don't pine to be back home doesn't mean I don't love home or the people of home. So it almost feels like sometimes when you ask that question and they don't have homesickness, they feel bad answering. Well, no, I didn't. Like something's wrong with me. It's like, no, that's how it is. That's okay. You're raised independent, and that's a good thing. I mean, ultimately, when we as parents, when we talk about our children, we're like, we talk about raising them to be independent little humans, but then we kind of feel bad when we didn't act that way when we, you know, in the opportunities and situations we find
Right.
ourselves in. That's interesting. Okay, so but you come back, you go down to Huntsville, Texas, to Sam Houston. How did you get back? What were there any reservations of, you know, I'm gonna kind of ask the opposite of homesickness now. Any reservations of coming back closer to home, not home necessarily, but closer to home, to Sam Houston?
No, there, that was the excitement part then, because that's when I knew I was full track and field mode then. It's almost like the conversations leading up to it, and I kind of, you know, I expressed it because at the time it was Greg Hensley who was the coach at the time. He was the one kind of driving that whole program and helping build it. And then that's when Curtis Carter took over later. But I knew I was going to move more into a coaching role. I knew I had that feeling like this would be a quicker stepping stone for me to get to where I want to be. Also, it was close to Houston. It's close, you know, I was an hour and some change away from my hometown. And I wasn't looking for it for that reason, but it really fit what I was looking for. And once again, it was an opportunity to kind of continue to grow. And that's when I start taking on the combined events, start training as a decathlete. And, you know, like I said, because I couldn't, it was hard to do that as a basketball player because you have no fall
Oh,
training.
sure.
And then all of a
Yeah.
sudden you're trying, but I still did it. I still started in kind of incorporating that. But it was my second year to really kind of just fully get engulfed in that and start really learning about the sport and learning how to get the most out of my body and the abilities that I had and the size that I had and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, this sounds like a big leap forward at a very young age into coachdom. You talked about you did your level one for crying out loud at this point. That's something that you normally do. Once you're graduating, you're in grad school or your first, you know, assistant's job, you were full bore, like, okay, I'm learning a lot from Coach Collier and I'm going to go to level one.
Yeah, no, I was reading manuals and doing things like that from all his level three work. I mean, that's how I
Huh.
started everything. I think I still have all the copies. Everything he's ever given me, every copy I've ever made, because that's where it really started connecting some dots to me. You know, it's like, okay, this makes sense. I've always felt this and I do this. And I don't know, the way I see a movement or a way I see an event, it's kind of a choreography. And when that choreography is off, you see it. And sometimes people look at things as segmented parts, and I just never really looked at the sport that way. It's a dance, it's a movement, and you're trying to get people to try and get similar to that. And this world knows that. It's TikTok, you know, all that kind of stuff. People doing these dances and people doing all these type of things. And it amazes me the talent these young men and women have. But I'm like, if they can learn a dance they saw on the internet in about a day or two, it's like, I've got to find a way to teach him how to do these three contacts on the ground or run this curve and go over a bar. Like, in my mind, it's like we have to find almost like an athletic version of TikTok, you know? And so that's how the science of the sport started making sense to me, and how you train the body, how you develop the body. And I learned a lot of that, because I think I was always a fan of science. I was always a fan of the human body and the study of human movement and things like that. Not kinesiology, because it was a PE degree. I was really interested because I'm like, this is intricate. Like, I liked, you know, anatomy, physiology. I like physics. I really, it spoke to me in a way that I understood. So probably like for people who coding, it looks like complete gibberish, but to them, it looks like a full picture. And that's what the science started looking like to me.
Yeah, that's a good analogy. I like that one, because me and you maybe look at computer code and it's like, okay, I have no idea. A coder looks at it and goes, yeah, this is what creates this image and what makes this function. Yeah, that's a good point. Well, and you're doing this, you're still competing during this time at Sam Houston.
Yeah, you know, and I wouldn't, you know, I'm not going to, you know, diminish my coach's role. I wasn't the coach,
sure,
but I could always tell, because he knew what I wanted to do. He always put me in positions to kind of lead different things.
Yeah.
And you know, if we had to do something that was on your own, I was going to take that group and lead it. And I was going to do this part. And I knew I had a fifth year to kind of really knock this thing out. And then I was going to transition straight into coaching. We've already had those conversations and was already making those kind of plans. And so my level of focus and attention to detail was sky high, because I'm like, I don't want to screw this thing up when they give me this opportunity.
You had the world's best internship for coaching. seriously.
it was fortunate. But I think now that I'm in this position now, it's like when you come across somebody that you hear and has a passion for coaching, you immediately put them in different positions. Anytime I'm working with an athlete that says they want to coach one day, I immediately put them in different positions, because I know how valuable that can be to learning this thing early, getting a handle on it early, and taking a little bit of a leadership role, not just a captain's role or put a C on their uniform, but really put them in position. Hey, do me a favor, take this group, bring them through this core routine, and y'all go ahead, head over to the weight room and just watch this and watch that for me. I got you, coach. Like, it's just, they're locked in. They have that, they're like a sponge at that time. And so you want to just pour as much as you can into them. And I was that way. And I was fortunate to have coaches and mentors and people that would let me bug them all the time about questions about the sport.
Yeah, I was going to go right to where you just went there at the end too. You know, shout out to the coaches, because, you know, ego is not bad. Bad ego is bad. It would be very easy for the coaches to have bad ego of like, hey man, you're the student, you're the athlete, you're the kid. Shut up and do the workouts. I'm the coach. Sure, you want to be a coach one day. In the future, you can do what you want, but you're going to listen to me. Instead, sounds like you had a much more collaboration type of like, okay, I you want to be this. I can see that in you. So therefore, I'm going to help, I don't want to say bless it, but like grow it. Then we're going to see, because, you know, it was kind of a tryout too. If you know, you could say all those things, but if you didn't do them, it's like, well, hey, James, you say you want to be a coach, but you know, you're not even running these guys through the warm-up when I ask you or what, you know. That's there's a lot of lessons there of coach to athlete relationship, not coach to athlete barking orders, you know,
right.
Do what I tell you to do. That's interesting. So you finish your undergrad degree, and then what's the first step of, I'm going to call it, quote unquote, actual coaching, paid coaching or graduate assistant coaching? What was the first?
It was Sam Houston.
Yeah.
So I jumped in that role, and it wasn't a GA position. It was a coaching. I'm obviously, we're not fully staffed. It's not six coaches. So I have a coaching role. I'm still heavily involved in the kinesiology department. So I take a GA through there and I start teaching and assisting in that area. So I teach a couple classes in the university and I'm also working at the outlet mall down the road in Conroe. And then I'm also coaching. So it's just that cycle of like, you know, you're kind of a broke young coach. And at the time, and that time, it's, you're not getting paid a ton of money. So you're still trying to make everything work. And so I just kind of mixed all those three and did those type of things to make it work. But that gave me my first time kind of full autonomy over a group. And gave me an opportunity to kind of, you know, the learn the ins and outs, and still, once again, not thinking I'm super coach and going out there, I know what I'm doing now, but it's just, once again, I had an opportunity to really learn from a collective group of people. I got a chance to go dive in, and now I'm going doing level two in Starkville, Mississippi, and as a 23-year-old or 24-year-old now. So I'm kind of continuing to progress in all these type of things and really kind of diving into the sport.
You did your level two in Starkville?
Yes.
Yeah, that's when I was there. Yeah.
Okay. Yep. Yep.
I did the ITC course and the multis course. That was like
Oh, yeah.
my third one, I think. But we hosted, yeah, it was when I was coaching at Mississippi State. I
Yep.
didn't That's so funny that you were there. What you've been at some, Nampa and Huntsville, Texas. You've been at some small places. That was a big complaint about bringing level two to Stark Vegas, maybe, was, it's hard to get to. There was nothing there, et cetera. How did you like Starkville, man? Come on.
Well, I
That
mean,
was my hometown for 2 years. I loved it.
it's the crazy thing. You because everybody says what they're going to say about different towns and different cities. Just like I lived in Lubbock for 9 years, and I thought that's still one of the greatest cities on the planet because I really it fit me.
Good point.
But when I went out there, it's just I was more intrigued about me moving back to a bunk bed in between sessions, and doing study groups, and that like I never had a chance to see start because. When I got there, I was so locked in, like, I'm about to do this thing. I'm about to ace this thing. I'm about to learn everything. I'm about to get everything I can out of it. So I don't have any memory outside of where we did our classes and where I was in this dorm. And that's kind of what my memory was. But at the same time, that was one of my first kind of let's get out and move and do some track and field. Let's move here. It's a little bit further because when you're in smaller schools, everything you're doing is kind of regionally. You're kind of staying right there. You're a bus ride away. And so hopping out there to me was just it was exciting, and I still don't think I've been back. Oh, I've been back one other time since, but it was a great experience. I think that was what probably helped land me my next job.
What did you do, jumps or sprints for that level
I did
two?
jumps.
So,
I did jumps.
Boo Schexnader and probably maybe K-Bud, maybe Jim,
I
and
think it was both of. I think that was K, but may have been one of his first time. I think that was his first time ever teaching in that session. So yeah, he was part of that, and it was to me it was incredible.
Incredible. That so my first level two was jumps and boo as well. Over actually back your way was at Boise. It was my very first one. And I remember I was a sprints hurdles guy, so I wanted to do sprints and hurdles. That's what I was gonna lock in, and that's what I was gonna be. And I remember Mike Korn, the coordinator back then, calling me and said, "Hey, it's all full, but I do have a spot in jumps." And I was like, "Man, I don't want to do jump. I'm not a jumps coach, all this kind of stuff." And Mike was like, "Hey, trust me, you'll learn a lot about sprints and hurdles as well in the jumps." And so I did it, and I look back now and I'm like, thank God I did jumps for my
Oh
first
yeah.
one. The very next year I did sprints with Coach Shaver and Coach Winkler and stuff, and that was amazing as well. But it changed my life. It was right in the middle. I coached for 10 years. That level two was right at my 5th year, so it was literally right in the middle. And if you look at the athletes that I produced my first 5 years versus my last 5 years, night and day. I mean, night and day. So I love that you had that same experience, because that
Yeah.
class was amazing. Truly, truly
Oh
amazing.
yeah, it's high
Yeah,
level
love
stuff,
it.
and it's still, still versions of it going to this day. And now
Yeah,
I'm part
absolutely.
of it. I get to teach in it. I get to instruct in it. So it's kind of come full circle. But no, that's like I said.
That's cool.
I still have my mentors today. I remember sending, the Boo Schexnator my fall training every single year. And let's go through this and let's go through that. And like I said, I was just so eager to figure this thing out. And that's really all you're trying to do is trying to figure it out a little bit and find out how you can apply it to what you do. So it was fun. That was my start.
Love it, love it. So, how long did you stay at Sam Houston on the post undergrad roles, and then where'd you go next?
Yeah, well, that's the unique part. It happened so quick. So I'm there basically a year and a half, and then the big shift happens at TCU, and Coach Daryl Anderson takes over at TCU, and it's kind of like I'm right now. It's a December move. He goes and starts his staff, and it's weird because one of my study groups, who I was one of the organizers, I'm getting these study groups together. We're going to ace this test. I'm thinking this thing is, this level two is everything, but. One of my people in the study group was DeAndre Hill, 17-time national champion, All-American at LSU, and she's one of his first hires at TCU. And we were one of those. That's where I didn't know who she was at the time. She knew who I was, but we were just hammering this stuff. She was in the same course. And then I guess when they get ready to get going, they throw some names in a hat. We need a jumps coach. We need this. She's like. I guess she threw it out there like you got to talk to this kid. Like he's young, he's just getting going. He hasn't done this that, but you need to have a conversation with him. And I remember I was on my way to Houston. I get a call from Daryl Anderson, and this is I've never interviewed for a job, and I just remember him grilling me. I mean, tell me your top five recruits in the state. Tell me you're this. Tell me you're that. And at the time, I was just one of them kind of crazy nuts anyway. I had a top 10 for every event. I had this thing locked in. I had written left. I'm recruiting kids. I have no business recruiting at Sam Houston. I'm like, I'm just going all in. And so when he called me, I was probably one of the most prepared people for an interview you can ever happen. Like, what about this kid? Would you recruit him? Well, no, I probably wouldn't recruit him because I've already talked to his coach. He's probably going to go to JUCO because this, this, that, and that. Well, this kid I would talk to because it's only a second year, blah, 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 blah. And so this is, I'm not even having jumps conversation. I'm telling him what sprinters he needs to go sign and right. what he needs to go do. And I'm obviously not cheating because I'm literally driving a car right now. So I'm not like I'm Googling this thing. You know, I go from like, yeah, I have no shot at this thing. I'm not getting this job because there's probably other people, but either I was willing to take the least amount of money or whatever it may be, but somehow I landed at TCU during that transition. And that's where I got a chance to kind of get my hands on some, you know, elite high caliber athletes and still dealing with that transition. Cause at the time they were going through some sanctions and we couldn't go postseason. So it was a big transition, but that's where I think I became, I got a chance to really kind of go on my own, you know, stand on my own 2 feet and say, can I really do this coaching thing?
I want to point out a really valuable lesson there. You know, one of the goals of the podcast is also to bring immense value to those who listen. You know, we have a lot of different constituencies that cannot speak today that listen to the podcast. And one of those groups is young people in high school and college that have an interest in coaching at some point. So I always like to bring as much value as possible. The lesson that you just brought up there is about networking. And, you know, networking is something that's really important to me. I have a passion for it because I like to teach networking correctly. So we think about the USATF convention. We think about level twos and things like that. And we're like, oh, networking, I'm going to go there and I'm going to hobnob. I'm going to meet James Thomas. I'm going to meet Mouse Holloway. And that's how I'm going to get a job. And that's not the right way. Networking is really about what value can you bring to other people so that you're top of mind when an opportunity comes available. And that example you gave, you didn't know who DeAndre Hill was. You didn't know that she was going to be at TCU and that they were going to, you were just like, okay, we're locked in. We're going to nail this level two thing. So you brought value of just being yourself and helping push forward the project. And then when she gets to TCU and her and DA are talking, it's like, hey, you know, I remember this guy from level two. We should be talking to this guy. Let's find out. You didn't try to meet DeAndre Hill or DA or, I mean, I was there at Starkville. There were tons of great coaches there. You didn't try to go meet them and, you know, get them on your resume that, you know, the quote unquote traditional network. And that is a really big lesson for you guys and gals that are going to clinics and the convention and level twos. Blessed, do that. You need to do that for your own education. Bring value to others. That's how they're going to remember you. That's how you're going to be top of mind when the opportunity comes. Going up and just trying to, you know, I don't use the words hobnob and, you know, try to impress other people to try to get a job or try to get their name on your resume. I'm sorry, guys like James Thomas and Mouse and DeAndre and DA, they all see through that. It's what can you do to help them in their program or their future programs that they're at. So I just wanted to point that out. That was a really great lesson there. I love that. So you go to TCU. Now, little different at TCU, and what I mean by that, for several reasons, right? TCU, it's the campus itself is a very unique campus, and I mean that in positive ways, but it's different. TCU is different than Texas and Florida, et cetera. But now you're at, I'm doing air quotes here, quote unquote, the big time, meaning there's a different caliber of athlete. Like you said, when you're at Sam Houston, you're like, yeah, it's probably recruiting kids that I probably had no business. And we understand. I think we understand what you mean by that. Now you're at TCU. How did you adjust to that caliber? How did you adjust? You know, I know DA very well, love him to death. You know, he's a certain type of head coach as well for your assist as an assistant. You've got to be copacetic with him and the rest of the staff. How did you adjust to this, this first full-time job?
You know, it was a unique transition because obviously it's kind of like now you hit the ground running because as soon as you get there, it's go time. It's not your fall training. It's not this. Mm-hmm. It's you're taking a bunch of kids that have already been doing something. You're trying to rebuild them back up, bring a positiveness to it and get ready to go attack it. But it was just unique because we were all kind of scurrying, doing our own thing. But that's when I kind of got heavily into the recruiting part of it. So that transition was fun for me. And I recruited for all the event areas. So, if, you know, home visits, California, that was my first time getting to travel, to start traveling the country to go try and find the best talent. Right. And so now I felt like there was no limit on what I could, the recruiting didn't change from a Sam Houston to this, but it's just how far I can reach out. Mm-hmm. It starts to change and the level of who will just not shut the door on me immediately changed. And so that was fun for me. That's when I really started to kind of get a grasp of that and start to realize that there is a power in a logo, because nobody obviously knew who I was. I didn't walk in there, oh, James Thomas, I can't believe he's in my house. Like, they had no clue who I was. But I had the backing of a logo that people knew, and they knew those Flying Frogs at the time. And and so I could get out to California, I could get out to Florida, and people were like, okay, let's talk. Let me hear what you have to say. Go ahead.
Well, I was going to ask, and I'm going to share a story with the question. How did your ego work to that? And what I mean by that is, so similar, my first job wasn't the quote unquote big time, but I eventually worked my way up to Mississippi State. That was my whole goal, was to get to the SEC. And of course, we're going to have to talk about that, by the way, to the SEC. And I remember thinking, because I worked at Ball State University, I worked at Neosho Community College, I worked at Troy University, you know, small schools that I had to explain where Troy University was, where Ball State was, all these kind of, yes, we're D1, you know, all those kind of things. I go to Mississippi State, and my thinking is like, oh, well, everybody knows Mississippi State because of Saturday, because of the football games, you know?
Yeah.
And I remember, I was like, oh, this is going to be so much easier to recruit. I knew I had to recruit a different level of athlete, but I was like, it's going to be easier. And I remember one of the first kids that I recruited was a kid named Elzy Coleman. He ended up setting the high school national record in the 400. And, you know, Elzy and I strike up a good relationship. And I remember asking him one day as we were starting to work on visits, I was like, well, hey, you know, Elzy, who else are you talking to? Who else are you going to visit? And he's like, oh, yeah, Florida, USC, I think TCU at the time. And I can't remember the fourth. Baylor. It was Baylor. And I was like, oh, crap. This didn't get like, my ego was like, oh, this is going to be so much easier. Slap in the face of like, oh, crap, you got to go beat your mentor Mouse, by the way. You got to go beat L.A. I'm in Stark Vegas. Love it and all, but it's not L.A. I got to go beat 4x4 you. I got to go beat, Coach Hart. This didn't get easier. Oh, my gosh, this just got harder. How did you did you have any stories of like, oh, yeah, I thought, you know, I'm Flying Frogs, I can just barge right in and they're going to sign with me.
Oh, yeah, 100%. I mean, recruiting doesn't get easier. Now, if you're not going after the huge fish, the big fish, sometimes it can be easier to get in the door and maybe not have to battle just the what you want to call the smaller schools or the this or the that. But I remember, like I said, when I compare my time at Sam Houston State, I tried to make life difficult for every school, every program in the state. Mm-hmm. I was like, I'm going to make it tough for Texas Tech. I'm going to make it tough for everybody, because at the end of the day, you at least better offer this kid some money, because I'm about to make it really difficult for you. And I'm about to express to their parents why the value of my scholarship is more important than the value of that logo.
Yeah.
And now once you get to that logo, it's like, okay, now you're doing two parts. You're still selling the value of that scholarship. You're still trying to find a way to split it up and dice it up, because the higher you get, it seems like the more and more they're trying to build depth and size and groups. And so you're taking that 12.6 and it's getting a little different. You're not rolling the dice all in on one person. So it actually became a little bit weirder when it became almost harder.
Right.
Because I'm trying to sell you, because I'm in this wonderful logo. I'm not investing in you. I'm going to need you to invest about half of this into us.
Right.
And so the challenge became a little more difficult. But yeah, you go in there and like, okay, you see these cards, you see these T-shirts. It wasn't social media posts, so I didn't know everybody I was visiting. But you walk in there and kids that loved this opportunity had every single letter sitting on the table, and you start seeing all these logos stretched all over the place. I'm like, oh, I have my work cut out for me. But then you know this is the time where you're calling. You're only allowed to call once a week or twice a week or do this. And so I'm maxing out all those kind of things. I'm trying to get to the point where I'm building this rapport, building these relationships. But at the, you know, I genuinely like people. I liked hearing their story. So it never felt like a hard task. I really got to know people, even if I wasn't going to coach them. It was just recruiting became something that was like building relationships and the opportunity to potentially you see them through to another level. Mm-hmm. You get to guide them to maybe being that next Olympian, that next medalist or whatever. So it was a weird hunt. And, you know, I don't know. It's kind of a weird thing. And you knew that whatever you did would hopefully benefit you and your program, but ultimately benefit them even more. So I felt strongly what I stood behind.
Yeah, that's
into that kind of
thing. Thank you. Sorry, I was interrupting there.
No, you're good.
That's what I talk about when I talk about uniquenesses, specifically of TCU, small school in the Dallas Metroplex, you know, Fort Worth area, very expensive private school. I tend to think, I think sometimes that we as coaches tend to think that the other people have it easier. And what I mean by that is, and I'll use the two examples you've given, so I don't have to worry about naming names, a Sam Houston and a TCU, that Sam Houston thinks, oh, you know, TCU and the like, they have it so much easier. They kids just fawn going to school. They'll just walk on at TCU. They get, you know, 10, 50 kids to walk on. And it's like, oh yeah, you know, to walk on at TCU, buddy. Yeah. Woo, man, that's expensive. And then the reverse, I hear the exact reverse where a coach at like a TCU will say, oh man, those quote unquote small schools, the Sam Houstons, et cetera, they got it so easy. They'll just give full rides. I can't get a kid at the dollar value that I got to be at. They're so easy. And the truth of it is that both is true. Both are hard. To get a kid to sign a TCU, an OU now, is extremely hard. Recruiting at Sam Houston is extremely hard. Recruiting at Northwest Nazarene is extreme. There's so many choices out there. And there's kind of both things. There's a lot of scholarship money available, but also not a lot of scholarship money available. It is extremely hard every single place. No one has it good. Hey, I know people think Mouse just gets to call a kid and say, hey, when are you coming? Even Mouse has to work extremely hard to get kids at Gainesville. Same with the USC's and LA, Texas's, et cetera. There's just too many good people recruiting coaches, and there's too many good schools. And fortunately or unfortunately, because it would probably not be great if the reverse, what I'm about to say is true. Not a lot of great kids. What I'm talking about is we need more. I'd love to have, 110 flat kids coming out of high school. That would probably be bad for the sport as well, though, by the way. But it's just extremely, extremely tough. And no one has it as good as you think they do. If you're looking at the grass is green on the other side, trust me, that grass has to be mowed and manicured. And that's not easy.
Oh, absolutely.
And vice versa. So cool. I love that. Thank you for that. So how long at TCU and how did it go?
I'm there 2 seasons. It's weird because I thought I'm going to be here. I'm ready to settle down. I want to find a house. Like I'm about to turn this thing back into, but it's weird. I still stuck to this advice, that Daryl Anderson gave me when, the Kentucky job had opened up because he was previously at Kentucky. He worked with Don Weber. And so they had a great relationship and I think he was kind of, we had a great thing building, great thing going, but he basically told me like the only way to move up in this profession, don't be like me in a way. He said, don't be like me. The only way to move up is to move out. And you have an opportunity to basically double your salary, get in the SEC. You're this young, you're only 25, 26 years old, get opportunity to have full autonomy over an SEC program. You'd be a fool not to take this thing. And like I said, trust me, when I tell you the only way to move up is to move out, as much as I want you here, this is the best move for you. And that stuck with me. And that's the same advice I've given to every volunteer coach who's worked with me in the past. And people, I'm like, I'm not saying you just want to go and bounce all over the place, but it needs to be strategic. It needs to be planned. It needs to be in a position where if you want to think you're going to elevate yourself to where you want to be, it's a lot harder to do it where you're at. You have to kind of move into those kind of positions. You can't just sit there and hope and pray that it happens. And I'm not saying there's anything wrong with hoping and praying. But I'm saying you also have the power to make these moves. So when I go out to Kentucky, and this is one of those weird things, I still at this point, I'm like, yeah, nobody knows my name. I'm just been at TCU and this, that, whatever. And I think I've been fortunate. I've been pretty good at the interview process. And I know other people that have applied for them. But I went there and I was just my authentic self and just kind of told them, you know, my goals, my ambitions, what I want to do and what I think I could bring to the program and how I'm going to approach it. And here's, you know, at the time I had a list for everything. I had a spreadsheet for everything. This is my plan for this and that. And so when we got there, you know, hit the ground running. And that's when, once again, I start thinking about my time of how many incredible coaches I've worked with. And, you know, I think of my staff that we worked with at Kentucky. I think every last one of them have been head coaches already or head coaches now, you know, so it was just a great way to kind of jump, you know, throw yourself into the toughest league. Then and still, you know, now and go battle with the big boys. And I remember, you know, who's this Kentucky team? Next thing you know, we have a track and field news, number one signing class in the country. We have this going, we have that going, and trying to build something up. And that was where I think if I learned something about who I am today, I learned another version of that there. because you still take a logo that was known for basketball and no football really, and you try and make it something that becomes more of a household name. And then when my boss retires there, Don Weber, after 30 something years, and I'm there 6 years, you're looking at this new transition now again. So, you know, it just, but I was able to learn a lot. It was, you know, would jump in there and, you know, leave out there with a, you know, I want to say a bunch to me, 7 or 8, 9, I think it was 9 conference champions, and, you know, started getting a kind of a boatload of little All-Americans here and there. So it became something where you start putting the things that you think you know to a talent level that's probably a little higher to some people, but it makes it no easier as a coach. You're coaching egos. You're coaching number one in a country kids. You're coaching the ones who's had all the guru coaches leading up, and they're going to tell you that this is how it should be done versus how you're going to do it. So it doesn't get any easier at those levels, but you sometimes get your starting point gets to move up a little bit.
Yeah. I like how you talked about the SEC champions. I've had one, you know, when I was at Mississippi, a male long jumper, and I still lead with that with every conversation. It's like, well, you know, I coached an SEC champion. That's a big deal, man.
No, it was.
I love the example of selflessness from DA there in regards to like, hey, man, if you want to move up in this profession, the only way to move up in this profession is you got to move on. I'm reminded of, you know, we had Boo Schexneider on the podcast, and, you know, he was adamant about, hey man, we don't pay our coaches enough. If there's an opportunity for you to make more, you got to do it. And one of the, I always put an asterisk to that, cause one of the additions he talked about, cause we always say, well, you know, our kids, I'm sure when you were at TCU, I had a pretty good group of kids, and this kid's going to be an All-American one day, and this kid's going to be a national champ one day. And we get to Kentucky and get to leave. He's like, man, I had this group, there's always going to be kids to leave, so bar none. And then he said this, and this really, I was like, oh, Boo, like, I'm not you said the quiet part out loud, I'm not sure you're supposed to say this. He goes, if you truly say you're doing this for the kids, how do you know you leaving that a better coach for them, not that doesn't mean a better coach than you, a better coach for them doesn't come in and take your place, and therefore they're better off. And it's like, oh, that's yeah. That's ego hitting. It's like, oh my God, that's right. No, I'm the best coach for my kids at all times. And it's like, well, maybe not. Maybe there's a better someone who communicates with them and their level better or whatever. So I just love that story of DA of, you know, he could have been very selfish there. And I'm gonna say rightfully so, of like, no, I don't want to lose my jumps coach. He's doing a great job. I love him. I know how to work with him, and he knows how to work with me. No, James, that's not a good opportunity for you. You know, you're at the best place. You know, he could have said a lot of things. He could have been recruiting you to stay, for his own good. And instead he was like, yeah, you know what? Maybe this is what's best for you. And, you know, that sucks for me, cause I got to go out and find another coach to replace you and things like that. It makes my life harder as the head coach. But if this is what's right for you, then this is what's right for you. I love that we could learn more of that selflessness, from that example from DA. No. Love that.
You know, it's a weird story too, connecting to that. Cause I don't know if this is I don't know if this makes me a good coach or bad. I probably need to read. I probably need to reflect on this. What I'm about to tell you.
Okay.
But I mean, if I have something I've been extremely proud of in my time, because I've made moves, and everywhere I've been, I try to be there. I'm not going with the intention of moving on.
Right.
I was in Kentucky 6 years, Texas Tech 9 years, and Georgia was a shorter stint. Probably one of the shortest that I've had in my later careers until I took this role. But I've always said this, and because I think as a coach, we have to be selfless, and we have to. And the one stat that I love is, even though I've moved, I've never had an athlete transfer with me. And my athletes know that. I've always wanted them to be tied more to the university than they are to me. I want them to understand that this is their logo for life. This is mine for as long as I'm employed here. And even if I've had parents, this is before it was illegal for somebody to be like, well, if you leave, they're leaving with you. And I would be honest with them, like, I'm not taking them. You know, I think they need to stay there. They need to finish their mission. They came here for a degree. They told me they love this university. And if they came here and it's just strictly because of me, they came for the wrong reason. And I've still stuck by that to this day. And I think even with the people I've worked for, I think they have an appreciation and hopefully respect and trust in that when I've left the program, my goal was not to sabotage yours. And I stood by that. I never held that as a ransom. I've never held that as a bargaining pitch. I've never held that as, hey, if I come here, I'm come bearing fruit. Like, these people are coming with me. I've never had that conversation with a single employer a day in my life. And I still stand by that, you know, to this day, because that's always been my coaching mentality. This can be your program for life. You get to wear these colors, these letters, you get this letter jacket, you're on these record books, you've been this All-American. Let them come in there and you know, induct you into the Hall of Fame 10, 15 years from now, and I'm there. But finish the mission.
Now, as the host, I get to challenge people because it's my show. I get to do whatever I want, right? And sometimes, you know, coaches are known for hyperbole. I want to ask that again, what you just said to confirm. You've had zero kids transfer with you when you've gone to a new job.
I've never had a single kid come with me to a new job.
That is an amazing stat for a couple reasons. I love how you did preface that of like, I don't know if that makes me a good coach or a bad coach. I love that because, you know, we talk about, and, you know, I'm on Twitter every day, all day, right? So that's where a lot of I like it because there's a lot of discussions there. And the discussion is, you know, kids, make sure you're picking a school that's your school for your academics, et cetera. We're, you know, 99.9 of us aren't going pro in track and field. So you better go somewhere where you love it. You're going to get a degree and can move on for, you know, a job, whether that's coaching or, you know, owning a business, whatever. And I think every college coach would reflect that as well for where you're recruiting. It's like, yeah, you know, if I'm recruiting here, I think this is the best school for you. Or, you know, you got to make that decision, but you know, here's what you know, we offer, et cetera, et cetera. And then a coach, you know, will take another job, which I have nothing against, no judgment at all on that. And then, you know, but you should come with me because you came to the school for me to coach you. So you should come with me. And I also have no judgment of a kid transferring, by the way. In fact, I'm probably, I probably make a lot of coaches mad when I talk about transfer portal that I don't care. I think they should all be able to transfer just like every Johnny chemistry major and Lisa English major can transfer. I don't care. I think a kid should transfer for whatever reason. Doesn't matter. Anyway, I don't know that stuff on a coach.
No.
Also saying that as no longer coaching, I'm pretty sure if I'd still coaching today, I might have a different attitude. But I love that attitude of yours of, I'm recruiting you for the school and the program where I am now. If I choose to go somewhere else for my own, family, whatever, it doesn't matter the reason. You chose that place. You should stay, or at least actively try to stay, you know, see what the next coach and do you still love the school, et cetera. You make your own decisions. I think that makes you, I don't know. I feel like it makes you, you're actually standing behind what you represent, what you say that you represent. That's the show me, not just tell me attitude of morals and character of the person who chooses to be the track coach. That's amazing, James. It really is amazing.
I've always felt like I said, if I'm coaching athletes, I've been blessed and fortunate to coach some extremely talented people. And like I said, if people in a lot of my programs that I've been a part of, like they know, like, if you do interviews, like, don't mention me. You got your faith, your family, your own hard work. Like, I've always enjoyed being in the shadows of that kind of thing. You put in the work, you put in the sweat. I write some stuff on a piece of paper. I do some things like that, which is still, I'm not trying to diminish what coaching is, but we get these accolades based off some extremely talented people, gifted people, people that have poured their heart and soul into this thing. And so I've never been comfortable accepting or taking the credit for any of it. It's never been a part of me. It's not what drives me. What drives me is that PR, that new accomplishment, that something that you've never done. Like, I sleep better when somebody improves. I have a list that I keep of every single person I've ever coached in my entire career, where they came at and where they finished at. And I have about three or four names that are in red out of about 200 and something that didn't improve. And I have an asterisk by them. I coached them 1 year before I left, or they never got a chance to develop. But, right, you know, I want to see progression. I want to see growth. And if I don't see a consistent level of growth and development, then I'm probably doing something wrong. Even if it's a lifestyle issue, if it's a decision-making issue, if it's this, it's that. You know, I want people to leave there with degrees. I want people to leave there improvements. And so I try and track all that stuff, not because it's something that I put on a resume. It's something that anybody ever know. It's because that's how I sleep better at night.
You know, I love you. I disagree with some of what you said there in regards to, I'm going to call it the limelight. You didn't use that word, but when you said, you know, I don't want a kid necessarily to reference me, et cetera. I think the exact opposite. I get so perturbed, and it's typically on the elite level. They're interviewing a Christian Coleman, a Fred Curley, et cetera. And I love, you know, what they say and everything. I want them to also say, yeah, my coach, Lance Brahman, and I, because we don't know these people. We know Bill Belichick. Yeah. We know John Capriati. You know, we know all these coaches. There are some amazing Capriati-ish coaches, you know, big high-level coaches in our sport, a lot of them. And no one knows who they are. It's athletes. It's so athlete focused. And I love the athlete, because without the athlete, we don't have this great sport. But this guy here loves coaches and knows that the architecture of what just happened on the track is between the coach and that athlete. And that coach is important. So
Yeah.
Always going to push back. I know what you're saying. No, I understand what you're saying. I'm with you. I just always have to point
out. And I would say this, like the athletes that even if you say that's not what you want, they do. They do it anyway. And you sit back and it's a humbling type of, it's almost like a proud papa type moment because you don't expect that. You don't, and when it does happen as a coach, you're obviously going to take it. You're going to take it graciously. And you understand that, you know, we played a big role in this partnership in this team. And there's a lot of other entities between athletic trainers and academic advisors. There's so many people that play a role in that. It's weird kind of being the sole, being given the sole credit over it.
I just want more. When Chiefs just won the Super Bowl and they interview the athlete, right? They interview Patrick Mahomes, but then they also go interview the coach, and Coach Reed gets to say, "Yep, you know, Mahomes did a great job leading the team, and we've worked on his efficiency or whatever." Blah 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 blah. I want that. I want when that OU kid wins nationals and he talks about, "Man, you know, we've been working on this all year. You know, I've tried to do better off the board, whatever." Blah 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 blah. And then they go to Coach Thomas and it's like, "You know what? Tommy, you know, came in with a goal and a dream and took coordination between." I want to see both sides. And part of it, remember, we all have our own passions and desires and loves. And so mine is coaches. So I want more. I'm sure everybody else listening is like, "Nah, I just want to hear from the athlete, man. We got enough coaches." I don't know. All right. Anyway, Kentucky for 6 years. And, you know, I am an SEC homer. You know, I think if there's a national championship for Tiddlywinks, somebody from the SEC would win it 10 out of 12 years. So you're in the greatest conference there is. Coach Weber, who was the first coach to recruit and sign one of my high school kids when I first started high school coaching. So I know Don for a long time, love him to death, still love him, get to work with him today, which I really appreciate. Retires, grateful. I love when coaches retire. I mean, that's a good thing. You've earned it. We should be doing more of it, meaning we have the money and resources to be able to retire. So I love for Coach Weber and others that have been able to do that. But that comes with a lot of changes when a head coach leaves or retires or whatnot happens. So where do you go next?
You know, that was a weird transition because it's unexpected. Just built a home. I mean, I've been in a couple, two and a half years at the time, three years about that. And I'm really settling down, planting some roots and really kind of looking towards that future. And I got to, you know, I think we have a great staff there. I think we're building something pretty special. But the one thing I also know too, and I respect in this sport, when there's any kind of transition as a head coach, and I've been given this by mentors and this, you better get ready to find a way to move on. Because even if you're the greatest coach in the world, you've had all these accolades, the common trend is to remove that staff and build your own. Everybody's always said, you got to get your own staff. You want loyalty, you want this, you got to get your own staff. And so I immediately, and it's at the time of the year where that movement's happening. So I go and talk to a few different coaches. I have some opportunities. Thankfully, at this point, I had a resume that could kind of stand on its own and I could be competitive with a lot of the jobs across the country. Not saying I was that guy now, but I still had champions. I had this at All-America. That helped me at the time. And so I end up turning down a smaller Division I head job. Turning down a couple other schools regionally. And then I've always known Wes Kittley forever because I try to be the thorn in everybody's side. And when I was at TCU, Sam Houston State, I'm like, I'm going to make it difficult for everybody. And so when that opportunity opened up and I was like, okay, Lubbock, oh, that's home. So I'm Googling it. I'm searching. I'm like, wait a second. That's still 9.5 hours for Houston. Like it's still like being in a different state. But it was crazy because I think at the time, and I backtrack a little bit through Kentucky, when I think I became a great coach, and I like to say not a great coach, but when I became I called a great coach when I had my son. It's crazy. He was born in 2009, and so that's a couple years into being at Kentucky. I was there. I got there in 06, 07. And I just remember ever since when he was born, like my attention to detail, the things that I would do, almost the compassion. Before he was born, I was kind of a little more regimented. I kind of tried to coach like the coaches I was around, the coaches I knew. You do it this way, you do it that way. And I had a personality, but it wasn't me. It wasn't fully me. I was still trying to be, I think, other people. Then when I had a kid, that's when I had to authentically be me. There's no manual for how to raise a kid. You can read whatever book you want, but you find out who you really are. And I think That's when my relationship with my athletes became different. I started trusting them to even watch my kids over a period of time. And so the trust was back and forth. And I started realizing I can go down the line. I can think of my kids and, oh man, this athlete helped raise them. That athlete, it was a part of it. This athlete did this. This was the one athlete I couldn't stand forever. I wanted to get rid of off the team, ended up being my son's babysitter and ended up being like one of the best people in my life. You know, so it's just it became something that really changed. And so when I started looking at jobs now, it became way more about where do I want to raise my family? Mm-hmm. Where do I feel comfortable having, you know, these type of things? And it wasn't the big city. It wasn't this. It wasn't that. It was like, OK, well, I go in there and see Lubbock. And to everybody that may not be everybody's cup of tea, it was the perfect town for somebody young trying to raise a family. You wanted them in an environment that you felt like, OK, if I left for a week to go to Eugene and left for another week to go to Eugene again and left for another week to be in Eugene again. Like my family would be taken care of, had a community. And so Lubbock became that spot for me. And that became automatically apparent. It was where I needed to be. And that really, for that 9 years, really propelled who I became as a coach and who I learned from as a mentor with Coach Kitley and the different staff members I got to work with that were all some incredible coaches. And once again, I go down that list. I'm seeing head coaches now. I'm seeing elite level coaches. And it's kind of fun to see things go full circle, you know, in this coaching path.
Because it's going to come up here relatively soon in your path as well, especially as we're now at Texas Tech. You said you turned down a smaller school Division I head coaching job, because that's what I was going to ask. Did you think you were ready for a head coaching job? Did you ever entertain that thought? You must have entertained it because you interviewed for a position. What made you decide like, this isn't the right time? Or maybe it was place, because you mentioned about, you know, location. Now you have family. What was it? And we're not naming the school necessarily.
Yeah.
I'm just talking about the philosophy of like, okay, I'm just either not ready or this wasn't the right opportunity, position, etc.
Yeah, that was the biggest thing. It was more about when I always see things, I try and make a decision and try and think well beyond just the immediate time. And like I said, it's a great program, you know, conversation, all that kind of stuff is incredible, but I still had so much I wanted to do. And I wanted to win a Division I national championship. I wanted to be part of that. I wanted to bring home some trophies. I wanted to do those kind of things. And I knew I was eager for that, and anything else, pay, whatever, it wasn't going to make me happy if I didn't feel like I had a chance to go after the biggest prize. I started seeing some of some of my coaching peers and friends and in the sport. I'm like, yeah, I want this moment as well. You know, I want the kids I coach to have this moment. And you only get those kind of opportunities at select programs, in my opinion. Mm-hmm. It's just the way this sport has kind of evolved, just like the football world. And, you know, outside of the NAU and the cross country realm, is like the status quo doesn't change much when it comes to the type of programs that are competing for these championships. Mm-hmm. And I knew I wanted to work at a program where I had that opportunity. That was probably the biggest decision making part of any decision I was gonna make. Can I potentially win a championship there? And the funny part is everybody said, yeah, you probably won't win one at Texas Tech. And I completely disagreed. I thought that was a place that we could absolutely build a championship level program. And I was getting ready to work with a coach who already had 29 national championships at a Division II level. So I'm like, if I can't learn from this guy, I can't learn anything in this sport. So even if we don't win, I'm about to take everything I can from him. I'm about to soak it up like a sponge.
You know, at this point, as you go to Tech, you know, you've had some pretty big mentors, and these are just the ones that I'm thinking of. Obviously, there's other mentors that pour into you. You know, you talked about your coach at Sam Houston, you know, DA, what an amazing person to be mentored by. Don Weber is an amazing person, a lot of experience, a lot of success. Wes Kitley, you know, his story. I need to get him on the show as well. His story from Abilene.
Fantastic.
He told one day we were sitting on the apron at Tech or at Texas for Texas Relays. And he kind of gave me the 5-minute story. And I was just like, oh my God, like, this is amazing. Like, you know, what he did at Abilene, how and why he went to Tech. And then Tech in general, just where it, from where he started to where it is today and what has grown with it. And, you know, you were along the way with that. It was quite amazing. Anyway, and Tech is where, you know, I knew you before Tech, but Tech is where, and I don't know why, I don't think it's because you won a national title and all that stuff. I mean, that's super important, super hard. But that's where it feels like you blossomed into, it's hard to say a complete coach. I mean, you had a lot of experience,
good way of putting it.
But it's where you and I, like, I started paying more attention to you and seeing the other things, not just, oh, he's got another great long jumper, but, you know, the other things, how you talk to your kids, how you talk to other coaches, how other coaches talked about you. You know, yeah, it's all I do is talk to coaches. So it's all we do is talk about other coaches. And so it was just interesting your time at Tech. And you said you were there for 9 years?
Yeah, I was there 9 years.
Yeah, it feels like a lot longer for some reason. Like, I don't just like, oh, he was at Tech for like 20. I don't know. So what did you, you know, Tech is a different school. It's so funny here. Because I said that with TCU. Tech is a unique school as well because it is in the middle of stinking nowhere. Lubbock is, there's nothing around Lubbock. And it is 9.5 hours to get to the grocery store, it feels like, in Lubbock. But it's a, I mean, there is, when you talk about college towns and towns that support their school, boy, you'd be hard to beat the support that Tech gets from its alumni and surrounding town and towns. How did you develop, you know, you're kind of a guy, it seems like you're always trying to develop and reach to the next level for yourself, for your coaching and your family and your, and the staff. What was the biggest takeaway when you look at 9 years at Texas Tech? What was the biggest growth for you during that time?
I mean, it was a lot of parts, but I think Tech was the first time I got to be the, it reminded me of my Sam Houston days, as weird as it may sound. It's where you start getting a bigger roster. You start having more numbers. It's finally a school that doesn't cost you, you know, $50,000 to go to. I can get a lot of in-state talent. I can go back to my mantra where I want you to come here, but I never want you to go in debt to come here. And so I was able to kind of feel, my conscience was a little more clear, knowing I can give people an opportunity to get a great education, not be in extreme debt, and still get a great athletic experience. And then going from there, just continue to develop. So I had huge numbers. I mean, I was coaching long, triple, high, multis, things like that. And wasn't even coaching the pole vaulters at the time. That was Tom Slagle doing an incredible job there. And my group was still over 30 athletes. And then he had another group of probably 10 or 11. So we had such a big team. And so that was the first time I had a chance to, it was just almost like, it was almost like the coaching version of speed dating. It's like, okay, I'm going to go here. Boom, bell rings off. Here's my time. We're moving to the next group, but I still had to give everybody individual attention. So I had practice going from 11 a.m. to 6 p.m. and I loved every minute of it. I loved every minute because I still felt like they deserved their time. But at the end of the day, I wanted no athlete left behind. And that's when I, you know, once again, that's, I think that's also my second child was born. And that's where you start. Once again, you start juggling more life and you start having more family. You start realizing that this is your family still within the track and field community. But I just remember each step of the way trying to build a culture to a championship level program. And the one thing Coach Kittley really did for me was allow me to be a part of all the decision-making, all the different nuances of what it takes. And, you know, again, I shook hands and spent time with donors. I did things like that. You know, there's things that, you know, as an assistant coach, a lot of times you don't get the opportunity. And that's one of the things I really asked of him was to, you know, if I want to do this at some point, and I'm not saying I want to do this now, I'm in no rush to run to this thing now, but I want to learn everything I can and I want to be in position. But at the end of the day, I really wanted to win for him. Like I really wanted he deserved that opportunity to lift up a trophy. And it started out by winning some Big 12 titles, which, you know, had never really been done. And then we started kind of getting on a good roll of that. And then we got to the point we kept getting that perennial number one. We were number one. We couldn't bring it home. And you knew that it took that little shift in that culture, meaning that talent has to be able to compete and perform in the biggest moments. And that's what if I take pride in anything, I felt like that group that I was able to coach there wasn't all X's and O's. It's people who really bought in, had a culture of a championship level mindset and really took it to a place where I felt like, no matter where you went, no matter where we went, if there's a Texas Tech athlete in it, and they had still, I still looked at myself as a small fish, that we weren't the big logo. We weren't this. And so it was a chip on the shoulder, you know? And so that chip that I had in that shoulder, I still felt like I was at Sam Houston State and I had something to prove. And I wanted every athlete to feel the same way because I was competing against the Sam Houston State, the SFAs, the UTSAs for the athletes I was signing. But at the end of the day, I wanted all those athletes to beat all the kids that just said, I'm never coming to Lubbock. Because Lubbock isn't kind of my kind of town. It eventually became a place like, okay, there's something going on in Lubbock. I want to come.
Right.
You know, and
I love the lesson there too. You're giving us a lot of lessons for those of us who are listening. You know, I don't think this is done enough where the head coach, I don't want to say teaches his assistants, his or her assistants to become head coaches, but gives them the tools that if they one day become, they're not so far behind that it takes them a year to really be an effective head coach. Donors, you know, so alumni support, equipment, budgeting, travel, scheduling, et cetera. I think that kudos to Kittley for allowing you to be involved and not just like, yeah, go coach your jumpers. I'm the head coach. I'll do these things. Like, I think there's a big part of assistant coach development that we're missing globally, specifically in track and field. So I wanted to point that out. Now, what's it like? I was taught a long time ago, one of my mentors when I was coaching was former head coach of Indiana University, Marshall Goss. And when Marshall took over Indiana's program and they were talking about national titles, and he was like, Mike, he goes, how can we win a national title if we can't win the Big Ten title? Now, things are different in the conference world today, to right. put that aside. But he was like, we've got to win Big Tens. We win Big Tens. That'll put us in the top 10. Pardon me. That'll put us top 10 in NCAAs. And then we continue to grow up and, you know, win the title. You mentioned winning Big 12 titles at Texas Tech. And you're right. I think if you look at the history, I don't want to say the history because I know I'll get it wrong, but I know if you look at Big 12 men and women's conference titles, it's basically won by like two schools. There's very few other schools that have ever won. That's why it was a big deal when Kansas State won, Baylor won one. Those are big, I mean, you know, they're quote unquote not supposed to, right? Texas Tech at that point was not supposed to win a Big 12 title. How dare you talk about an NCAA title? You haven't even won the Big 12 title. What was it like when you started winning Big 12 titles and then started talking about, okay, well now, what's the next goal then is NCAAs? How did you progress to that level, how, the progression, move it up?
Yeah, like I said, it's a mindset and culture thing. We just had to, like I said, Coach Kittley knows how to win championships. I think, and I think he's always done a great job of trying to bring staff and people around that are like-minded in those areas. But I think the one thing that is probably, I want to call it a gift and a flaw, and I'll tell him this, he lets his coaches do what they do. Right. He doesn't micromanage. He doesn't sit there and hover over the top. And so once he got a staff that, to me, that was cohesive, not saying any other staff wasn't, but yeah. we ended up building a really cohesive staff and unit. And, you know, even Calvin Robinson, who was there, we worked with, won a championship. He's the best man in my wedding. I was the best man in his. We both were Sam Houston alum, and he claimed he coached me. I think that's absolute bogusness. He never coached me when he was there, but I always felt like I could tell him what he should have done. but now we started bringing that together. It's just like everybody started just going to work. And if you have a coach that trusts you to go out there and recruit and coach and do your thing, and everybody came with a like-minded mentality, that winning part became a lot easier, you know, and getting competitive people. And we're all competitive by nature. So I'm like, this money's going to run out pretty quick. So I better go recruit hard, you know? So even the way we recruited stepped up, because we started throwing the names in a pot and like, this is number one, this is number two, this is number three. If you get them there, we're signing them. So I think just that mindset of how, what we're looking to do. And I think the way we went about things there, building a much deeper, bigger roster. And once again, having five guys in a high jump, sometimes seven women in a jump, like we went a way that just wasn't the prototypical way.
Right.
And that allowed us to kind of get in there and go, I wouldn't call it sneak a championship, but we didn't do it. I mean, but outside of Divine Odaduru, who's, you know, double national champion and that, but outside of that, it happened in a bunch of field events. It happened with two pole vaulters. It happened with a long jumper, triple jumper. It happened with a discus thrower. It happened, you know, you started seeing it spread across the board. So if something were to falter, we still had a backup plan. And I think once we had more bullets, not just a ranking, that if something were to go bad, we still had a chance to be competitive, and we had a chance to win, and we broke the Big 12 record in points scored and all that kind of stuff. We started doing some things that just had never been done before. And that was a lot of credit to Coach Kittley giving us the autonomy and ability to just go out there and let's just go be rock stars. Let's go let our athletes shine and let's go see what we can get done.
I think we lose sight, I've said this several times on the podcast, in track and field, of how hard winning is. I think it's because, you know, we have 20 something events, both men and women. So, you know, every meet we go to, there's a winner and things like that. But winning is hard. So as you extrapolate that up from the individual event to the conference level to the national level, to win a national title, that is Super. Everybody wants to go after the national title. I agree with you. There's probably about 10 to 15 schools, and 15 might be hard pressed, that will that have the opportunity to win a national title for a lot of different reasons. Take us through, what's it like to win? 99% of us listening right now will never win a national team title, be part of a staff that wins a national team title. What's it like? What was it like when you realized you were going to win? I don't know if you knew, like, before the 3000 or before, you know, before the 4x4, if it came down to the 4x4. Talk us through a national title, man. That's pretty stinking special.
Yeah. Well, you know, I think what made the national title unique is that I don't want to claim this is a stat that's a locked in guaranteed stat, but I think I have probably more fifth place finishes as a coach at a national meet than anybody else that I've ever met. So I've been one spot outside that trophy. And so that used to irk us, you know, and we went through a period where, you know, getting up to fifth was also a big win, because we mm-hmm. started there, maybe mm-hmm. projected to be 11. Mm-hmm. But then we had a spree there of being the number one ranked team, the number two ranked team. Like, it should have been a for sure. You're coming home with a trophy, right? But there'd always be something that can pop up. It's this injury. It's this. It's that. You're almost not like you're some cursed or jinxed or something, but you knew, we knew that we went there with kind of that, those hitters. And if any one of those hitters faltered, we were in big trouble. And then when you start going that culmination of going after a national title, it just felt like it was just primed and ready to go. We had a great indoor-outdoor season. I felt like the culture of the team had, everybody was locked in doing the small details that it took to win. I felt like the group I was coaching directly was like, they were just locked in. It's almost like, okay, we're going to go take care of conference. We're going to kill it here. We're going to go to this. We're going to do that. We're going to go to regionals. We're going to do that. Like, we didn't lose anybody along the way. And typically when you're taking that journey towards winning a national championship, and especially with the regional format, preliminary round format, you can have some casualties, but we didn't have any. I'm just like, okay, this is different. This has a different feel. Then we're about to be in Austin, and, you know, and anybody that's in any school in the state, if you don't go to UT, you find a way to despise UT. And I love it. Like, I've never had that kind of notion. Now that I'm Oklahoma, it's even more. I thought that was our symbol of the school. I'm just like, guys, what are we doing? Like, this is our symbol? I thought we had a completely different one. And so you get to Austin, you get a lot of your family, your friends, your crowd, my entire family's there. It's just, my kids are there. And it's always a little bit tougher to do when in most national championship settings, but you felt it was prime to happen. And once we got to a certain point moving it in, and it's the most relaxed I felt, even though the ridiculously high, we had a couple, you know, casualties, just the heat issues. But we're just our people been ready to go. And by the time it was said and done, it's just like, you knew that championship was rolling. And once we hit that 60 points, and I knew we were kind of there. And it was a surreal moment because, like I said, we had a huge crowd, huge fans. You had people doing the chant. You had the athletic director there. You had administrator. You had support. You had people. You had an administration that already built championship towels, like, that already said national champs. Like, there were people that were just locked in and like, it's our time. And so that was a special moment because you knew you had worked really hard. You knew you took a bunch of losses to teach yourself how to win in these moments. And now it's time to, you know, to put that formula to the test. And we did, and there's champions out there. There's going to be teams that there may not look like they're in a hunt, but they know how to win. They've learned how to win. And so there will always be the most dangerous programs in our sport. And we hadn't at that point. But then once we did that, it became something like, you gotta worry about this program from here on out, because you've had some people that learned how to win. And so they're going to always be a threat. They're going to always be a factor in our sport.
How do you bounce back the next year after winning a national title? Meaning, you've tasted the sweetest of fruit. I mean, it is the highest honor in our collegiate track and field, is to win the national title as a team. And it's extremely tough. You mentioned, you know, you can go there with the greatest team in the world. It only takes one mistake to knock yourself out of contention. Or the other way, you can go in thinking you're a third place team and something happens to another team and you're suddenly in the hunt for the national title. And it can even come down, as we've seen, to the very simple last leg of the 4x4 to win the national title for several teams, by the way, that, you know, that could have won in that instance that I'm referring to. So how do you, the next year, and you don't win, you know, how do you, like, even though you have a successful year, but you didn't win this year, you know, how do you just, you've been to the mountaintop. How does anything compare at this point?
Well, I go back to a story I had with an athlete probably isn't my Kentucky years, but I had an athlete who won a conference championship. I'm sorry, athlete won a national championship, and I remember asking, like, okay, what? He was talking to the team, mentioning all the things about it. It's like, well, explain your championship run and what is this, what is that, you know? And he went into in depth about what it felt like to win. But he said, the hardest part about winning is the fact that I'm coming back next year and that pressure is to do it again.
Mm-hmm.
And like, I didn't feel pressure. Like, I was just hungry and eager to get this first one. But after you win one, it's just like, I never really thought about how it feels to try and come back and repeat something. And it's one of those things, and this isn't a coaching bragging moment, but it's one of kind of things. And I was like, man, I really realized that's a difficult one. And the one thing I've always said, and I've had 9 national champions. And the one thing I love about that part is none of them have ever won just one. They've all won at least two. And I started realizing how tough that is.
Yeah.
And especially in a world and in a sport where everybody's hunting for the top. And I know that Texas Tech team was special, but I also knew that was senior driven,
mm-hmm.
senior laden. And so we're gonna have to do some rebuilding. And as soon as we got to the point where we thought we had a great program ready to go, we had this lovely thing called COVID shut us down. We're the number one program again, and we have some great things going. We're getting ready to go after this thing, and we get shut down for a season.
Yep.
But it was a fun challenge. But at that point, the culture and the path had been set. Like, we didn't have to talk about championships. We just had to prepare for them. I felt like our job became easier. The people that walked into the program weren't coming to the program because it was their favorite color or because it was a school that offered them a scholarship or it was because, you know, they couldn't get into the school they wanted. They came here because they wanted to be part of a championship level program. And so that mindset as a whole just started to change. And I loved it. It changed me. It changed my thinking. I didn't become an elitist. I just became hungry for the biggest prize.
Yeah, it's amazing. Quite amazing. Well, around this time, you and I are starting to have more of a relationship. We talk to each other. We know each other fairly well, decently at this point. And I just have a great admiration for you and a school that I thought high of had a head coaching opportunity available. And so I came to you. I can't remember what meet it was, but I come to you and I was like, hey, James, you know, it feels inevitable that you're going to be a head coach one day. I don't know what that means, by the way, because just because you're a successful assistant doesn't necessarily mean it. But I think for me, it felt more of like your character and your leadership, like, okay, you know, you're going to lead a program, not necessarily because you're a great coach, but because of who you are. And so I said, hey, you know, if you're interested in this school, I have some contacts high up. I would be very willing to be honored if you wanted me to call in and, you know, say, hey, you need to go talk to this coach. And, you're very gracious. You're like, hey man, thank you. That means a lot to me, that you would say that. But, and yeah, I think one day I'm going to be a head coach as well. But it has to be the right situation. It has to be the right time, everything. Now, hearing your story about your family and where you're moving now, it all, like, I'm getting a better complete story now, but you told me that, and so like that just kind of locked away of like, oh man, here's a guy that I think could have any coaching job in the country, and he's being very selective. Like, that meant something to, like, oh, that's interesting. And then a year or two later, you do leave Texas Tech, because you'd also mentioned, like, hey man, I've got a great thing at Tech where we live, my boss, like, it's great, man. But then you do leave Tech and you go to another, not only great program, but, you know, I don't know that I can think any more of a person than I do of Carol Smith Gilbert. You go to Georgia with Carol out there. And it kind of, like, you know, you don't know this. I've actually told you this. I was kind of like, huh. I mean, I get it. You know, I get working for Carol. That might be the draw alone, to be honest with you. And, you know, maybe I get Georgia. It's a great program. They've done great things and will continue to do great things. But I was like, but that's not a head coaching job. Like, I kind of thought maybe in my head, like, your next thing was going to be the head coach of Georgia or something. What led to the decision to go to Athens? Well, question mark.
Yeah, no, that was probably the shocker of my life, because I had no intentions of making any moves. I was going to be at Texas Tech until that opportunity arose, and the right opportunity, like you mentioned, because I felt like that was important. I had other opportunities. I'm not ever trying to diminish the fact that there's, you know, a head job. I'm above it. It was never about that. So I've never been above any job. I just, one thing I learned from Wes Kitley about being a boss is that you know, he coached one event. He coached 800 almost the entire time for the most part at Texas Tech. And he still did. He has his hands on everything from a leadership and weight room and everything. But he coached one event. And that scared me, the idea of probably if I become a head coach, I got to take a step back and I don't get to coach and interact and do the things that are fun, right, everyday fun to me. And I never wanted to feel like I wasn't in a rush to turn this into a business, turn this into a profession yet. And when I saw some of my people that besides DA, I mean, who still coached all the sprints and did that. I mean, but Weber really only coached like the middle distance 800 and it was one of the kind of things that always kept me a little more hesitant. And when and Coach Carroll, she knows, she tells everybody this, but she tried to hire me a number of times to come out to California. I was like, Coach, that's the one thing I'm just not. I'm not a California guy. I'm not a, like, I have to take my lovely 3,500 square foot home that I pay not nearly as much and turn it down to about 1,000 and pay double the price.
At least.
And I wasn't ready for that life.
Sure.
But I always appreciated her. It was at a point where, and I never want to get to the point where I say like, I've learned everything I can learn. I've accomplished everything I can accomplish, but I'd learned so much from Wes Kittley that I was like, and even at the time I was like, no, I'm not making this move. You know, she had reached out to me when she took that Georgia job and I talked to the staff. I was like, no, I'm staying here. It's not the right timing. I'm loyal and I'm not stuck here, but this is where I want to be.
Mm-hmm.
And then we transitioned. I remember going on a family vacation. We're settled. We're staying. I'm going to Great Wolf Lodge and a Metroplex and we're about to go and just enjoy this thing. And then I remember getting a call from the AD, getting a call from the associate AD, getting a call from the SWA, and then talking from Georgia.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And at the time, my wife is even considering possible transition to career because she works for Walgreens and she does this. And in the time, this is COVID. So she's administering shots. She's doing this. She's doing that. She's like, you know what? This may be time for a possible career move.
Wow.
And, you know, when you start going to these kind of schools, that can make one or two calls and you got a great position here or there, whatever. And then it drew her in a little bit. And it's the first time because normally I'd go in a house and it would be a simple conversation. Hey, this school reached out to me.
Nope.
End of the conversation. Hey, you know, this school reached out about this. No.
No.
End of the conversation. And this is one of the first time. And then when I first brought up Georgia, no. But it was the first time her mindset changed because we also had our in-laws that live with us. And we started thinking about how far they travel just to kind of do some things to enjoy themselves and start looking at different areas. And so the biggest draw for me ultimately when I decided to make that shift to Georgia was I really wanted to learn from another championship level coach. I knew in my mind I'm getting close to transitioning to where I want to be, comfortable where I want to be. And to know that I don't say I learned everything I could ever learn from Westfield. I learned if I go sit with him and talk for an hour, I'm going to learn something different.
Mm-hmm.
But when I got to work with Coach Carroll, it really started to bring another level of structure and how she does her things and how she builds a championship level program. And the one promise that I have with Coach Kittley is like, I can't make this move until you allow me to be somewhat in your shoes. Like, and she knew I was coming there with the mindset of, we're going to go after this thing wholeheartedly, but ultimately this is one of my goals is to be a head coach. And I've always said, I never wanted to be a head coach. And I've told this to everybody, you know, I've never just wanted to be a head coach. I wanted to be a championship level head coach. And so if I didn't feel like I was at a place that you could be championship level team and it could happen in a short term or long term, but I'm looking a little bit more in like that five-year window, meaning I can't contest for one in that amount of time. It probably wasn't for me because I'm not going to get the same joy out of a paycheck as I would the accomplishment of trying to reach the highest pinnacle of our sport.
Yeah.
And so that was the biggest shift. And I think over that two and a half years I was there with her, I learned so much.
Yeah.
I learned a ton. And like I said, she may seem like the big bad wolf to a lot of different people, but she's probably one of the softest teddy bears I've ever worked for.
Oh,
but she runs a program and she runs a program in a way and she sets high expectations. And it's amazing how you can build young men and women up when you put expectations, but you also, you follow up with that. You hold them accountable. You do things like that. And you grow way quicker than just kind of sometimes that free reign.
I don't want to diminish your time at Georgia. For sake of time, we're going to skip over it a little bit. Also, because Carol has promised me that she will be on the podcast. In fact, it's your fault. I blame you that she's not on the podcast now. We were getting ready to start working a schedule, and she's like, "Mike, I have to replace James, and you know, we're getting ready to do blah blah." And I was like, "I get it. I'm always blessed when you guys can give us any time, especially in season, for crying out loud." So Carol's on the, you know, when she's ready, when she has time for me, she'll be on here. I echo a lot of the things you said. You know, I've worked with Carol for, decades now at this point. I love her to death. Leader is always the word. Like, I don't even think of her as a track coach, and that's what she does, but she's just a natural born leader. If she was the CEO of Walgreens or IBM, they would be the top company in their spot. She's just 100%. A speaking leader, man. Love her to death. So let's transition from the transition from Georgia to Oklahoma. Having heard what you just said about, you know, you'd go in and Mrs. Thomas would say, "Nope, that's not the place. We're not going there. How did OU come in to where you either had to convince her or she was on board? How did that, this was the opportunity to go for the family, not just you, for the family? How'd you get her on board, or was she already on board?
Yeah, well, I think you always have your mental list, and sometimes you write things out. You know, I may write down, okay, me and my have a discussion. Okay, here's if one of these eight schools came calling, because we're in a range now where you don't call them, they call you, and those kind of programs. And if one of these kind of schools came calling, what would I wholeheartedly go after and pursue and look at legitimately? And Oklahoma was definitely on that list. Growing up in Texas, I thought there was three big schools. There was Texas, there was Texas A&M, there was Oklahoma. Yeah. So if you're an elite level player, you went to one of those three Texas schools, and I pretty much put Oklahoma in that category. And so that was always a place I always could see from the outside looking in, like, man, this place could be special. The proximity, all those kind of things. But when that change happened, I was never expecting anything to happen in the month of December. Mm-hmm. I just thought, okay, you know, I'm going about my day. We're getting ready to start the season. It's holiday break. It's all these things about to go on. Next thing I know, it's just like I'm getting called. I'm having these conversations, and what turns into should be probably a month process. You're going through all this. It turned into about a 7 to 10 day process where it's just a whirlwind.
Wow.
I mean, everything's happening quick. I barely get a chance to talk to people. I'm getting my first call the next that same night. I'm on a Zoom interview. You know, it just, and I'm thinking it's going to be with one person. It's almost the entire administration, you know? So it's it moved quickly, but I try to, you know, just like how everything started going to TCU, I just try to be as prepared as I can. Over the years and time, I've always continued to build on my philosophy, build on my plan, bring it to life within a small microcosm of a group, and then hopefully be able to ultimately kind of move that out to an entire program. And so I felt like I've been prepared for this for a long time, not preparing to just walk out and leave a program mid-year. That's probably the one thing that's going to be the toughest part I've ever done in my coaching career, outside of leaving Lubbock after being there 9 years. Mm-hmm. It's walking away from a group that, you know, put their sweat, blood, and tears into trying to accomplish something special. And I don't think that goal will change that I'm not there, but it's hard not being there with them. Yeah. But then this is one of the few places where I think that no matter who you are and how you look at it, it's a move that if you have an opportunity, whether if it's the right time, the wrong time, you have to take those kind of opportunities. I can't look above this one. I can't think there's something better. Not saying, you know, I'm looking for something better, but
this opportunity will be there in 2, 5, 10 years. Yeah, that's right.
So that's what you start to notice, that these things don't open up very often.
So in, you know, as you're listening to this, when we're recording here, you know, give James a lot of grace here. He's been on the job for less than 2 months, less than 6 weeks, actually, I think. So so when I ask these questions, James, you're forgiven when you say, you know what, I just don't know at this point, Mike, but I'm curious. So, you know, coming into a program halfway through the year, and, you know, we started off today's podcast by talking about, yeah, you know what, you just go to your comfort zone. Let's go to meets. Let's get things done. Let's get prepared, and let's prepare for the future. How are you, you know, now learning about your journey, learning about your thoughts? Specifically, I'm thinking around, you know, Wes coaching just the 800 and Don, I shouldn't have said just, I'm sorry. I hate that word. Wes coaching the 800 plus all the other millions of things he has to do. Don coaching more middle distance, you know, less coaching, because as the director, as the head, there's so much more that you have to do, and you have to do really well for the program to succeed. How are you preparing? How are you, it's hard to say, how are you handling it? Cause it's only, you know, like I said, I think it's less than 6 weeks technically that you've been there. What's your vision of how you're, that you can share with us, that you are going to move the Sooners forward in regards to what you're going to coach? And I'm not looking for specifics necessarily, are you going to try to coach all the field events and multis and still be the head? How are you starting to put all these plans? You've thought about this for a long time. You're a planner. You have thought, when I become a head coach, I want to do X, 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 X. How are you looking, at least through this semester, indoor, outdoor season, how are you looking to put those plans into action?
Yes, awesome question. No, I would say
again, I said I'd give you all grace, brother. You've been 6 weeks.
No, this is
you are still trying to figure out how to drive from home to the office. I get it. Everything's so new. I know.
No, it's crazy. When I wrote out, when I had a playbook, if you want to call it a playbook, a plan, a vision, it was going to be against the grain. And I always put it, this is my analogy, I always said, and Nick Saban is the greatest thing probably to ever happen to sport when it comes to coaching and teams and dynasty. And he had a ridiculous stat that none of his assistants had ever beaten him up till just recently, whatever. And the reason they never beat him is because they all left those programs and did it Nick Saban's way. And you can't beat Nick Saban doing Nick Saban stuff unless you have Nick Saban's people.
Interesting.
And so I've always been at a point where all the lifelong lessons people told me, get rid of your staff, hire a new one, do this, do that. I'm like, I have the opportunity to work with some incredible coaches that were already put in place here that I know for a long time in the sport. I think they're going to do an incredible job. And when I look at my playbook, and this isn't knocking any program, a lot of programs have four sprint coaches, three minimum. All your elite level programs have minimum three. And they go heavy in that area. I was like, why can't we be a program with four field event coaches? Mm-hmm. And when I wrote up my ultimate plan, you know, I was going to try and put it in a way where I can put people, because I'm trusting, even when it comes to athletes, if I'm anything, I'm more of a Kitley, where I'm going to let you do your thing. And I can assist. I can be a part of it. Coach Kitley let me do everything I want with a high jump, but he was over the USATF high jump development stuff forever. So he knows the high jump well. He's never once come to me and like, I think you should change this. Mm-hmm. Whatever screw ups I was doing, he allowed me to make them to the point where I got them right. But ultimately, we know how to all count points at the end. And we're trying to get to the point where we're all counting the same points and at high points. But that was one of the unique gifts I was giving to come in mid-year. I feel like I have an incredible staff. I had to make some additions. I didn't have to make any deletions. And I don't plan to, because I am kind of one of them loyal type people. And I feel like no matter, even if things aren't perfect, you can kind of build it to what you want to be. And if you can set a path, a vision, kind of an idea of what you want, then if I can envision this thing being more like an Olympic training center where everybody has specialties, everybody contribute in certain areas, you know, I don't have to come here and start saying, well, I've coached this, I coached this decathlete, I've coached this high jumper, give me all your high jumpers, back out and I'll do this and you go do that. I'm like, no, I didn't like to break up that continuity, because I also know the value of coaching and how athletes can tie into those coaches. And so I respect that. And I think the athletes and the coaches hopefully see that from me and understanding that I'm not here to take away your people. I'm here to help build on that. And I think we built a level of trust in a short amount of time where if you have asked a question or we can do this or I see this technically, I can speak to you. I can even speak to an athlete with you, through you, not in a way that I'm trying to overcoach, I'm trying to do this, but you know, we can come together to find out the best path for them. And if I could, and the one thing is, if I was going to take this thing over as a blank slate, I don't think I could have hired this good of complement of staff, because it's a threat to bring somebody and say, no, all of a sudden you're underneath somebody's wing. Especially if you've been established, you've been doing this thing a long time, and Coach Langley and Coach Davis, who coach, you know, same events that I've been coaching forever. I trust those guys wholeheartedly because I know what they've done before I got here. I competed against those guys as, you know, as a coach at different schools within the same conference, different conference. So it's an absolute luxury to be able to say, you know what, I got to go deal with this office stuff this entire Tuesday. I'm not going to touch the track probably for one of the first times in my life. And I feel perfectly fine about it. Mm. And I didn't know how I'd feel about that.
Yeah, I was going to say, I feel like that'd be really hard for you.
Yeah, I thought it would be difficult. But like I said, now that I'm in a trusting situation where I do trust the coaches that we have, from the distance to the throws and things like that, like I don't have to oversee it. But that's the same way I'm with my athletes. You know, there's times on purpose, like here's, you know, the warm up, do it on your own. I'm not going to. there's times I'm going to watch everything. There's other times I need you to make sure you're independently locked in.
Yeah.
And we have a group that's super tied into the athletes. These athletes love them. They trust them. They'll do whatever they ask of them. And they're buying into a culture of what I'm trying to kind of create here, which isn't some major shift. I didn't walk into some horrible environment. No, it's just, I know one way. And my way is to try and get it to a point where we're all fighting for the same thing. And now that I feel like it can move that direction, I never would have thought this transition would have been as, I don't want to call it easy. I don't want to by any means, but right. as fulfilling as it's been, in a short amount of time. Once again, we're in our happy place. Now we're training, we're competing, yeah. training for a couple of days and traveling again. And this is now becoming a flow that it feels much more comfortable. It feels like it's in my wheelhouse. We'll get back to a bunch of paperwork and a bunch of decisions and where we're traveling to meets and how we're going to budget this. Right. But right now, it's fun.
You brought up an important topic that I'm afraid we don't have time to really delve into, and that's learned helplessness. When you're talking about sometimes your athletes, they need to warm up on their own. There's mm-hmm. plenty of meets that you go to that you don't have direct access to them. So they've got to be able to make adjustments and things like that. But that's an important topic, but we don't have time. But to wrap us up today, James, why don't you tell us about what's got you excited, scared, concerned? So not only new program, that alone is a huge shift in what you are doing as a coach and as a person, but you guys are also transitioning into the SEC. It's just not fair or fun. I was talking to, it'll narrow down to either Oklahoma or Texas. That's as far as I'll go, to one of the coaches there when it was first announced. And I was like, man, that's just not fun. When I was in it, we had 12 teams and it was just a bloodbath then. I mean, we ran 3 flat in the 4x4 and never ran at conference, by the way, because it was like, just get ready for nationals. That's crazy. Yep. Right. And then they added Mizzou and A&M and God bless, that made it a lot harder. And now we're adding OU and Texas. This isn't a conference meet. This is mini nationals. And of course, you know, through the lens of I'm an SEC homer here, of course, what's got you, like I said, excited, concerned? Tell us about what's going on here in the future as you look towards building OU and the image of James Thomas and going into this. You got to go against Carroll. You got to go against Mouse. You got to go against the Bucky. I mean, the hitters. Come on, man.
Yeah.
Lonnie. Althea, I've missed every one of them. They're just unbelievable people and coaches. Yeah. And you've got to figure out how do you bring the Sooners up to the top.
I mean, it's a dream come true. I mean, like I said, it's the one thing about our sport, what I've always appreciated, and I think everybody who's in the sport can appreciate, this isn't like the NCAA tournament where you have to get your special bid because you win your conference, this, that, whatever. If you're one of the elite, you go to the same meet as everybody else. So no matter where I've been, I've competed against the SEC. I've competed against the Big 12 because there's only 9 people in the final. There's only 8 lanes. There may be this, there may be that. So that's been our world. So there's one meet a year. We come together and we just clash. But at the end of the day, everybody has to be worried about the 16 teams in the SEC because those same 16 teams are going to be in Eugene. They're going to be at whatever indoor championship site we're going to be at. So the whole level of the sport is raising. And there's teams that are all stepping their game up for that. But it makes my messaging so much easier because, once again, you get evidence right there in front of you. And I can look at the SEC alone as a conference parameter, but I can also just show them a national list and say, what used to win it doesn't even make it anymore. What used to do this won't even get you a final spot now. Mm-hmm. And so I think the level of thinking just has to elevate. I think the way the administrations and staffs and even the coaches have to prepare and recruit, we get to kind of fine-tune, narrow this thing in. It's not the greatest, but probably for the high school level and for the mm-hmm. recruiting and all that kind of stuff, because the pressure is on to get people that are almost ready-made elite in the transfer portal, which is a whole nother mm-hmm. Topic there. But we're kind of put with a new task of, you know, you got to come in and go, but I don't want to lose that whole concept of development. Mm-hmm. I think development, because I still don't have a national champion that I've ever coached that you'd have to Google who they were coming out of high school. And I appreciate that. I still appreciate the fact that we can still coach and develop champions. Mm-hmm. Athletes can still develop, but you just have to have a level of patience. So I got to find a mixture of that. And that's going to be with some upperclassmen, some experience, but also some youth that I'm going to give them time to be elite. And I'm going to take my time and patience in that. And we have events that we coach and a staff that I think can coach those developmental events. You can't develop somebody into a 9.9 sprinter, but you absolutely can develop into a 7.5 high jumper.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'll, add on and drop the mic with this. You know, I think sometimes the OUs and Floridas and Georgias get a knock when, you know, other coaches will say, yeah, they don't want to develop anymore. You know, they just want the ready-made 10 flat kid, 7-5 kid, et cetera. And it's like, you know what, you know how many of those kids are coming out of high school? Zero. You know what I mean when I say zero, yeah. Maybe once every, you know, few years. So to win the SEC in the 100 is going to take sub 10, 9, 9, something. Well, that means you've got to take a bunch of 10, 10, 10, 20, 10, 30 kids. By the way, that's a handful of kids, and right. Develop them. And to develop a kid from 10, 3, 10, 2 down to 9, 9, that takes work. Just like it takes a coach. There's a lot of coaches out there that can take 11 flats to 10, 5. That's amazing to me. I know 10, 5 ain't going to win the SEC, but that yeah. You've developed. But it's just as hard to take that 10, 3, 10, 2 kid down to 9-9.
Yeah, that margin is so much smaller.
So much smaller. So, so hard. So I always fight back when it's like, yeah, they only want ready-made kids. And I just like, boy, that show me one. Maybe there's one in the world. Right. You know, we are recruiting globally. So yeah, maybe there's one in the world that can step in and immediately become an SEC, a national champ right off the bat. But the vast majority of them, they have to get better to win those titles. So I was going to fight back that. James, man, I can't thank you enough. You know, it really does mean a lot to me, you know, as we do these podcasts. I always say, you know, this podcast is not easy to listen to because it's long. We're at the hour and 54 minutes right now. But that means it's also hard to do them, to record them, and you know, to ask you this time of you, James. You know, in a normal time period, this would have been hard for you because to get 2 hours of your time, you, like I said, you're six, not even 6 weeks on the job. You're at little known secret, he's actually at a meet right now, he's not even in Oklahoma right now.
I don't own this beautiful backdrop. This,
yeah, he wanted to make sure we point that out. If you are watching on YouTube, that's not his house, that's not his office, that's not his decor, that's his home for the weekend here, for the track meet. So, but James, I just want to say thank you, man. It really it humbles me that you'd give us the time. It's newest. Important thing, most valuable thing that you can give us is time. So I'm really grateful. I think, you know, I'm amazed by your story. I think that's why we didn't get into some of the topics that I think would have been natural to talk about with you, and that's transfer portal and things like that. But I think the journey of where and how you got to where you are today is extremely interesting, valuable. I think there's people listening that are gonna be like, wow, wait a minute, James, this big time track coach, he didn't go to school at an LSU and that's how he got the job. And I was like, it's really cool to see that you can go to any school and be any type of athlete and work your butt off, network correctly. I think that was a great lesson that we learned today, and continue to move up and be real cognizant. James, what a great lesson about not just chasing that logo, but making sure it's right for you, right for your family, right for your children, right for your wife. I think that is an extremely valuable lesson that we all need to continue to work towards in our careers, whether you're a coach or you're a guy like me on the private sector side. So, man, just so thankful, grateful that you join us today, and we're rooting for you, man.
I appreciate it, Mike.
It's 6 weeks in. I can't wait to see 6 months and 6 years, man, because it's still a whirlwind right now for you, and it's going to be exciting to see you put your fingerprints on this. You know, like I said, I've admired you for many, many years, so I'm really excited for you. I know it must be special because you told me the school that I wanted to nominate you or refer you to is a special school, and if you didn't take that one, so it must mean OU is really, really special. And so I'm excited. I'm happy for them. I think they're lucky to have you. And just we're rooting for you, man. I can't wait to see how it all kind of continues to move forward.
I appreciate it, Mike, man. Obviously, keep doing what you do. You advocate for the sport, and that's the only thing we can ask and appreciate in this world, because this is doesn't get the coverage, doesn't get the press, and you do an incredible job of kind of advocating for it. So definitely appreciate that. And I've caught a bunch of your podcasts, and you know, you may get the lowest ratings you've gotten a long time on this one, but I still appreciate it. I still appreciate it my time either way. So don't hold it against me if people really aren't interested in hearing me talk.
I love you to death. All right, everybody, let's prove him wrong. Of course, if you're now listening at this stage, you've already listened to it, so you've already proved him wrong. But it's great. I'm glad to have you as guest number 250, man. It's a real honor for me to have you on the show. Thank you guys and gals for being here listening. This show does not exist. We need the guest, right? But we need people to listen. If a tree falls in the woods and no one's there, does it make sound? Does a podcast exist if no one listens? So I'm so happy and proud that you guys would be here. Join us next week. We'll do it all over again. We'll go to, it's not a round number, but we'll do 251. So check us out next week, and we'll uplift and honor another great coach in this amazing special. Thanks, everybody. Have a great week.
If the ghosts who appreciate the coach, the ones who point people most. Every season needs a voice of reason, speaking of growth. You gotta bet before you carry the load. It's coffee to the soul for those of us who stay on the go. Proper handoff to stay in the zone. What you packing for the road? There's more than one way to the goal. Take notes, that's paying your toll. It ain't practice if your purpose ain't clear. It can't happen till you listen with both ears. You can't mentor without a mentor's years of experience. You can reinvent those years. Every plan's got a standard to live up to. Enterprise sacrifice, can you give up you? It's a choice and a fight, not a win or lose. It's not a ploy, but advice so y'all can make more moves. It's not about how to, it's all about why. You don't know till you know who you are inside. 6 million ways to tie, choose none. So we all cross the finish line, the work ain't done. So we learn from the experts, we all gotta put in the legwork. Gil Athletics is a network, it's all about connections. Put together for the profession, so every track coach could be a blessing.